Okay. Going back on the record after lunch, it's about 1:02 p.m. Mr. Martin, you're still under oath. Mr. Martin's back in the witness stand. Mr. Simpson, you may proceed with redirect.
Thank you, Your Honor. Mr. Martin, I hope you had a good lunch. I think where we left off, quite frankly, I got a little confused about what the different models are and do. And so I think it might be helpful to kind of go back and regroup and sort of walk through both what the models are and what they're intended to do. So can you help me understand what the modified IRP model is, what's in it, how it's built, how and what it's intended to show?
Sure. So the modified 2015 IRP model is supposed to represent kind of where we were coming out of the last IRP that we filed. So the amount of renewables that had been proposed in that IRP, some of the orders that came out of that IRP, such as some incremental demand response, things like that were included in that model. There was no constraint of trying to achieve a certain carbon-free percentage or any carbon emissions reduction percentage. So it's simply kind of where we left off at the end of the last IRP.
And that included the retirements of Sherco Unit 2 in 2023 and Sherco Unit 1 in 2026, correct?
That is correct.
Okay. And the 85 by 30 plan, the other bookend model that's in the record here, what is that trying to show? What 85 of what by 30?
Sure. So the 85 by 30 references the percentage of carbon-free energy as a percent of total generation on the system. So what we did in that scenario is we essentially took the 2015 scenario and then added in a bunch of incremental renewables to make sure that we achieved the approximately 85% carbon-free as a percent of total generation by 2030. So it was essentially that base case modified 2015 scenario with a bunch of additional renewables layered onto that.
So if I understand you correctly, if you sold 100 units, 85 of those units would be produced by renewable generation.
By carbon-free generation, so renewable or nuclear would count as well.
And did you include storage scenarios or those other kinds of technologies?
At that point, I don't believe we were including storage options, but I think our view on storage has always been that a combustion turbine generally represents the resource type that we would consider storage as an alternative. So, our thought is anytime we identify a CT out in the future, we'll evaluate storage against that CT as well.
Okay. And so it's 85% of total sales, regardless of your past carbon usage or anything like that, correct?
Correct.
And how do you achieve that 85 by? So help me understand, you tell strategists, I want to achieve 85% of renewable generation of total sales. So strategists, you pick the best outcome?
So I think what we did is we just essentially forced in renewables. So we did not run an optimization in strategist. We just kind of forced in amounts of renewables in different years to get to the 85% by 2030.
So essentially you had generic solar generation has X percent capacity factor, and which equals Y amounts of generation. And therefore, if you needed to, and your forecast said you needed to sell 1,000 units, so you figured out the best mix of solar and wind plus your existing nuclear fleet to achieve that outcome?
That's right. In our price forecast, solar is a cheaper resource in the future as the tax credits roll off than wind. So that's why we primarily selected incremental solar. There was a little bit of incremental wind, but it's primarily solar.
And so once you set that up and you jammed it in, what then does strategist do for you? Why even use the model at that point in time?
So that component of the energy capacity mix is fixed. However, strategist continues to solve over time. And, as I mentioned before, there's retirements and PPA expirations. So strategist recognizes those as it moves forward in time. So in future years, when it gets to a point where there's a capacity deficit, it looks at other resource options that we give it, such as a new CT, new combined cycle, and it'll select the incremental resource that makes the most sense.
So you fix the amount of carbon energy, And strategist then essentially solves for a lease cost on a generic basis of how to meet any capacity and energy needs.
Correct.
Okay. And then you recently filed your 2019 IRP. Let's call it that so we don't confuse it with the modified IRP. So 85 by 30 was 85% carbon-free generation. What are those goals in the 2019 IRP model?
So in the 2019 IRP model, we, as I mentioned earlier, we pivoted away from focusing on the carbon-free percent of total generation, and instead we're focused more on the carbon emissions reduction percentage. So when we say 80 by 30, now we're talking about reducing carbon emissions 80% from 2005 levels.
So it's a emissions amount as opposed to a percent of sales amount in the 85 by 30.
Correct.
So 80 by 30 and 85 by 30 is really apples and tomatoes.
Correct.
Okay. So what do you jam in to achieve your 80% emissions reductions by 30? How do you solve the model that way?
So essentially what we did in the IRP modeling process is we allowed a full optimization. You know, we had wind, we had solar, we had modeled energy efficiency and demand response as supply side resources as well, and let those compete. And what we saw is when we did a full optimization, the model economically selected an abundance of solar. And the only way we could tamp down the amount of solar that was being added to the system was to impose some firm dispatchable constraints as well, because you get to a point in the modeling where you're adding so much solar that we had some reliability concerns, and we wanted to make sure that we had sufficient firm dispatchable resources to maintain reliability of the system.
So as a foundational basis, what you essentially do is you set the stage for Strategist, and then you give it a menu of resources to select. Is that how that works?
That's right. And, you know, we imposed the 80 by 30 constraint, but then we also ran the model without the 80 by 30 constraint, and you essentially end up with the same expansion plan because the solar is just the most economic resource option given the capacity and cost assumptions we make in the model.
Were there different menus in different models? In other words, does Strategist have different resources to select in your 2019 IRP model versus your 85 by 30 plan versus your modified IRP?
Yes, some options are the same, some were updated and changed.
Are there any that are worth noting?
So we did not, in the North Dakota modeling here, we had an embedded amount of energy efficiency that was accounted for in the load forecast. We did not model energy efficiency as a supply side resource. And then on the demand response side, we embedded the 400 of incremental demand response that's been ordered in the demand response forecast, but we did not model that as a supply side resource either. So,
and that's
primarily the DSM resources.
And that's in the modified IRP and the 85 by 30 plan?
Yeah, that's right. So okay. The assumptions were different here than they were in the IRP.
Okay.
For DSM.
And so when Strategist selects stuff, what's from this menu? What kind of considerations does the model take into account to solve? Is it just capacity need? Here's the lowest piece of capacity, so that's what gets put in, or are there other things that are put into the model?
Sure. So it's primarily just energy and capacity economics. So what resource fills our capacity need and provides energy benefits in the most economic manner?
So Strategist helps you make a determination whether you need higher capital costs but more efficient generation versus lower capital costs but less efficient generation?
Yes, that's correct.
And does Strategist take into account your system balancing needs as well?
No, not necessarily, not on an hourly basis.
So when you were talking about the 2019 IRP model, you had mentioned that the model was adding so much solar that you had some reliability concerns. Can you elaborate on that a little bit, please?
Sure. So, you know, again, we have solar modeled at certain costs, and we were assuming a 50% capacity credit for solar. So given the cost forecast we had in there and the fact that it provided that 50% capacity credit, again, the model sees that as the most economic resource. You know, we're adding 4,000 megawatts of solar in the plan. That's a lot of solar in itself. Going beyond that amount of solar additions, we had some concerns just given the state of the MISO queue and everything there. So The concerns about going to too high of renewable penetrations were one set of concerns, and then the other was just making sure that we maintain enough firm dispatchable. And we had an example from this past winter where we had the polar vortex in late January, and then we had another challenging day on February 5th where our net load was extremely high. We didn't have a whole lot of wind and solar show up, and essentially it kind of demonstrated that if we go to super high penetrations of wind and solar, we can't necessarily depend on them. We need to make sure that we have a backstop, and that's where we're targeting a sufficient amount of firm dispatchable resources to supplement the renewables.
And when you talk about firm dispatchable, are there particular operating characteristics that are important?
Yes. So it's resources that can operate that are not use limited. So, you know, storage, battery storage, demand response would be use limited resources. We need resources that are available 12, 24, 48 hours that during periods of a renewable drought type condition, we have a resource that has sufficient fuel supply and we can operate reliably to serve load during those low renewable conditions.
And does ramp rate matter from that perspective?
Yes, and ramp rate's going to be increasingly important in the future as more renewables come on the system. And, you know, as the sun goes down and as folks have seen in California with duck curves there, we're certainly not at the penetration levels they are with solar, but down the road we could be. So you could see late evening ramps that are very significant with solar resources declining in output as the sun goes down. Wind is variable as well, and you know, fronts can blow through where it's very windy, and then you know the winds calm. So taking all that into consideration, with more renewables on the system, we anticipate more volatility with net load levels, and therefore dispatchable resources will be of more value.
And in each iteration of the model, did you update your pricing for what you were seeing in the marketplace for the resources you put in the menu?
So I think the costs that we had here may be consistent with what we had in the IRP. We may have updated them slightly. I know we were working with our energy supply group, and that's something we do regularly to make sure we're reflecting their current expectation of resource costs. But I would have to double check that. I'm not 100% sure if these tie out perfectly to the IRP.
Okay. And so Strategist then says, from the menu I've selected, let's call it a combustion turbine. So Strategist, through your good work, your resource planning analysis says a combustion turbine is needed in, let's call it 2028. What happens then? What does that mean to you? And then what do you do with that information?
When Strategist selects a combustion turbine?
In 2028, today.
Sure. So to me, that would indicate that at that point in time, there's a capacity need. Strategist is identifying that. But if it's selecting a CT versus a combined cycle, it likely sees that there's sufficient energy on the system. So it's looking for the cheapest form of capacity to fill the capacity need, also recognizing that it doesn't necessarily need the energy, so it would select the CT versus a combined cycle.
So that means you need that type of capacity resource, but then you got to go find one, right?
Correct.
And at that point, so that CT that shows up in the model is essentially a proxy for those kinds of operating characteristics that may be available in the marketplace at that time?
Yes.
Which could include a PPA or a renegotiation of an existing PPA?
That's correct.
And it could also include building your own?
Yes.
Greenfield or brownfield?
Correct.
Okay. So Strategist also takes into account, and as a resource planner, you also take into account sort of how things get dispatched and the energy value and the energy of the efficient generation of different kinds of types, correct?
Sorry, can you repeat that?
Sure. As a resource planner, not only do you take into account the capacity need when Strategist selects a CT, but Strategist selects a CC, it means you have an energy need as well, correct?
Correct.
And so from a resource planning perspective, you really want to look for a resource that is maybe a little more expensive from a capital perspective, but is going to give you more efficient energy because you need energy at that point in time.
Correct.
So when you're looking at potential energy resources or resources that provide both capacity and efficient energy, you know, what are your options in the marketplace today?
So, you know, I think it's what you mentioned earlier. It's, you know, if we were to hold a competitive solicitation, we could bring forth some owned options. Other developers may bring forth some new greenfield site potential, or if there's existing assets out there that have do not have PPAs or their PPA terms are expiring, they may bid in as well.
So based on what you're seeing, would that generally be gas fire? Or would you use coal? Would a coal plant, assuming you could build a new coal plant, would a coal plant be part of that? Would a gas-fired unit be part of that? Would it be a wind backed by a CT? I mean, what's the universe of technologies?
Sure. So the universe of technologies is basically gas resources, so both combustion turbines, combined cycles, and then renewables, both wind and solar. We have also included battery storage as an option in our IRP. Again, we think that a storage will compete with CTs. We've identified a need in our IRP that's out in the 30s, so we have time to wait and see how those costs develop.
And why don't you consider coal?
I think because of the environment we're in right now, you know, renewable costs are coming down and are economic, and we're also seeing extremely low gas prices. You know, I just spoke with somebody during the break, and I heard that gas prices are $2.30 an MMBTU today. So, you know, gas prices are extremely low, and that's just the new environment we're in based on the shale and the horizontal fracking, and seems to be the environment we're going to be in going forward, just because there's such an abundance of supply, and that's really pushed down prices for the foreseeable future.
So at that pricing level, would an intermediate resource like a combined cycle be cost competitive with a baseload resource like, say, Sherco?
Yes, it would, and that was another discussion. I talked or exchanged some emails with some folks in our commercial operations group and asked them how we're pricing our units into the market today, and they sent me the first offer segment for both Mankato 2, Sherco 1, and King, and the first offer segment for Mankato 2 is actually priced cheaper than both King and Sherco 1.
And can you explain what a first offer segment is?
Sure. So it's just in terms of like the marginal dispatch price. So on a daily basis, we submit offers into MISO based on our, you know, fuel and variable O&M cost. And essentially we provide an offer curve. So the first offer segment is just the lowest price at the lowest output level. And then we provide different offer segments at higher output levels for each resource unit. So for that first lowest priced offer segment at that lowest price segment of capacity, Mankato 2 is priced cheaper than both Sherco 1 and King.
So all things being equal, MISO would dispatch Mankato 2 before Sherco and King?
That's right.
From an economic basis?
Yes.
Well, that's very helpful. So let's go back to the modeling on the record and your IRP model. When I think Mr. Armstrong was talking to Ms. Shea and to you, and I think there's general agreement that the 85 by 30 plan is probably closer to reality based on what we're looking at that's in the record today than the modified IRP plan. Do you think that's fair?
That's fair.
And you had called these bookends. Help me understand why you modeled on a bookend basis.
Sure. So, again, the timing of this was unfortunate. It kind of landed smack dab in, you know, the middle of a period where we were getting ready to file an IRP. Obviously, we were considering big decisions around other plants, but generally we felt like the biggest driver for the economics of Mankato was going to be the amount of renewables on the system in the future. I don't think it's if coal is on the system or not, or if other gas resources are on the system or not. It's really renewables is the big challenge for combined cycle units. So that's where we had the modified 2015 IRP because we felt that was a good starting point, given that that's what we came out of the last IRP reflecting. And then we also wanted to provide that high bookend where we really added in a lot of renewables and really tested the economics of Mankato combined cycle when it has to compete with a significant amount of solar and some incremental wind as well.
So when you talk about competing with solar, what do you mean by that?
So going back to how Strategist works and how it optimizes when it creates an expansion plan as it moves forward in time and it recognizes capacity need, As I mentioned earlier, right now it's selecting all solar because that's the cheapest resource out there. So that's what I'm referring to.
Okay. So in other words, the value proposition goes down because you've rejiggered the model to achieve this 85% of sales being from carbon-free energy.
That's right. And the solar is a must-take resource. So when we add 6,000 megawatts of solar, the energy is flowing onto the system. It's not being dispatched. It's must-take energy. So that's additional energy that is serving load that reduces the opportunity for Mankato to dispatch and serve energy needs. So it really it reduces the opportunity for Mankato to look economic.
And you think that look really provides the high-end bookend. When you were to look at the 2019 IRP modeling assumptions, do you think it would make Mankato look more economic or less economic than the modified IRP scenario or the 85 by 30 plan?
I think it would definitely make it look more economic than the 85 by 30 scenario. And part of that is that firm dispatchable constraint that we've imposed, where we are saying we need sufficient amount of firm dispatchable resources, which Mankato is, and the only other resources that provide that capability now are other combustion turbines or other combined cycles.
Now, there's got to be more to resource planning than just running a model, or you wouldn't really have a job. Is that a fair thing to say?
Yeah.
So at some point, really, you have to make a judgment as to what are you going to do about the future. Is that fair?
That's right.
Now, you had mentioned the timing is unfortunate. Is the timing also unfortunate because this is the time that MEC was put on sale?
Yes. Yeah, it was not necessarily under our control in terms of timing.
And so at this point in time, you really just have to make – there's a sale, so you have to just make a decision, correct?
Correct.
And so is that one of the reasons why we're seeing this kind of stress test of all these different analyses?
Yes.
Is it also fair to say that the world is changing very often? And like Commissioner Christman said, frankly, there's always some different kind of rubric that we're trying to fit into?
Yes.
In your judgment as a resource planning expert, will the ownership of MEC as a combined cycle generally allow you to meet what you know today is the rubrics and what you think may be the rubrics tomorrow?
Yes.
Is there any value in MEC as being owned versus PPA as part of your overall resource mix when you have to make decisions?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, we get additional capacity after MEC 1 expires, and, you know, it's an intermediate resource that helps meet that firm dispatchable need at a very economic cost relative to other thermal options, other gas options.
As a resource planner, is there any consideration to your mix of owned resources versus PPA resources?
Yes, there is. You know, we try to maintain a diversified portfolio. We have a fair amount of PPA resources and owned company resources. This is not the only PPA resource that we have, so converting it to owned doesn't significantly skew the owned versus PPA mix. So, you know, again, we think we have a balanced portfolio. This is a 300 megawatt addition in the near term, post 2026 of combined cycle that helps us maintain portfolio diversity, and having, you know, renewables, intermediate gas resources, peaking gas resources, and a swath of other resource types as well.
And if you had your druthers, could you create different models and different modeling scenarios until the cows come home to see what would be the absolute perfect outcome?
Yes.
As a business enterprise, does the company sort of have to make a decision at some point in time?
Yes, and that's why we put forth bookends that we felt represented reasonable ranges to consider.
And is that essentially how you overcome that analysis paralysis?
Yes.
And at this point in time, you have to make a decision on MEC, correct?
Yes.
And it's based on the analysis you've seen, it's prudent to purchase MEC?
Yes.
And based on the analysis you've seen, the other options available to you are reasonably modeled such that the concerns Mr. Armstrong had with renewing existing PPAs, if you waited for that pricing, I mean, help me understand how you analyze all that.
Sure. So I think a CT is typically viewed as the lowest capacity cost resource going out into the future, and MISO recognizes that with their cone value, their cost of new entry. They publish it on an annual basis, and it sets the maximum clearing price for their annual capacity auction. So fundamentally, long-term, we view a CT as the minimum capacity price out into the future. So I think the fact that we're allowing the model to select generic CTs, you're giving it the option to select the lowest capacity option that it's going to have in the future, and we're comparing that here to a Mankato acquisition and extension, and the model is showing that there's benefit to adding Mankato rather than keeping the PPAs and then adding CTs for the tail end.
Can we talk a little bit about the configuration of the Mankato Energy Center? You had testified earlier that it was initially built as a one-on-one. Can you explain what that means?
Sure. So a one-on-one is just, so there's a single simple cycle CT along with the steam generator attached to it. Two-on-one simply means that there's two simple cycle CTs with the steam generator attached to the two simple cycles.
And you testified earlier that essentially MEC 2 turns that one-on-one into a two-on-one, correct?
Correct.
And so the capital costs of building out MEC 2 essentially reflect the cost of adding a combustion turbine to the MEC facility in total, correct?
Generally, yes.
Okay. And you also testified regarding your transmission outlet available to you at some of your retiring CT plants. And I just want to make sure I'm clear. Is it your testimony that you couldn't squeeze in a CC under those interconnection limits?
Yes, that's correct. Given the size of the generic CCs we're evaluating, we could not. The size is not conducive to the amount of interconnection rights we have at those locations.
Okay. One last question. You had testified to this in your pre-filed written testimony, but I kind of want to just give you an opportunity to talk about it. I was wondering if you can provide some comments on Mr. Majors's proposed customer discount rate.
Sure. So I think Ms. Shea referenced this a little bit as well. You know, given that there's no precedent for using a discount rate, you know, at that level, you know, we have used the company's weighted average cost of capital to inform our discount rate for all historical proceedings that I'm aware of. So that is kind of the standard. That's the standard that all utilities kind of adhere to, and you know, we had asked in discovery if anybody was aware of anybody else using the customer weighted average discount rate, and Mr. Majors, I think, acknowledged that he's not aware of any, and we're not aware of any either.
Thank you. Witnesses available.
Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you. What's a discount rate?
Discount rate? So when you calculate the net present value of an investment, you apply a discount rate to it to essentially, if you're looking at a stream of payments or costs over like a 10-year period, you apply the discount rate to calculate the net present value of that stream of payments in current year dollars.
Okay. Cost of capital?
Essentially.
Okay. So that's how I like to call it, because I think it's shorter. Do you agree with me that customers do have a cost of capital?
Sure.
And would you agree with me that the customer's cost of capital is more than NSP's?
I think it's debatable. So, you know, I think Mr. Majors's calculation uses credit card interest rate, which I think was around 19% to arrive at his weighted average of just north of 11%. Personally, here we're looking to procure an asset. You know, if a customer is going out and looking to procure an asset like a car or a mortgage, I would argue that they're going to pay a lot less than 19% interest on an auto loan or a mortgage loan. So I find the credit card interest rate difficult to reconcile when there's an asset that's being purchased, so it's kind of an asset-backed security.
Your discount rate is a weighted average through your jurisdictions, correct?
Correct.
And I'll let Mr. Majors explain his more, but his is, like you mentioned, also a weighted average, correct?
Correct.
Was it your impression that Mr. Majors was saying you have to use the customers, or you should at least consider the customers?
I suppose he was just saying you should consider the customers.
And in your analysis, you're not even considering the customers, are you?
No.
Who's ultimately going to pay for the MEC facility if it's bought?
So it's the company's cost of capital.
Okay. And how does it recover that cost of capital?
it charges its ratepayers, via electric bills.
And then the company gets a return on that as well, right?
Correct.
You're guaranteed to get the cost of this back from your customers if it's approved in your jurisdictions.
That's correct.
Talking, I don't want to get too far down the rabbit hole on computer software, but let's talk about Strategist for a second. Strategist never said in your models, go out and buy the MEC facilities, did it?
No, because we never gave it the option prior to this transaction coming forward.
The transaction, if I recall the testimony correctly, you learned that MEC was for sale in August of 2018.
Correct.
And the MEC energy would have already been built into Strategist at that time.
That's right. We had the PPA modeled, so we had included that assumption.
So whether you buy it or lease it, Strategist doesn't tell you that.
So we tell Strategist what the contract looks like if it's a PPA or what the revenue requirements look like if it's this acquisition.
And so at that time, MEC 1 is in there till 2026 and MEC 2 is in there till 2039.
Correct.
And if you wanted to, you could have said, put MEC 1 in there until 2039. Let's see how those numbers run. Right?
We could have, but then we would have had to make an assumption about what the extension price would be, and we don't know what that would be.
And I think that's my point, is no matter what results Strategist spits out, it's either based on the inputs you put in or on interpretation after the numbers, after the run.
Sure. So I think what Strategist was doing when we had the PPA modeled is after 2026, when MEC 1 retired, it would look at the list of resource options we had available for it, and it would select a CT or a combined cycle. So it was selecting CTs, which represent the cheapest cost of capacity, to replace that capacity. So that's essentially our base case. And then our own case is if we layer in the revenue requirements and remove the PPA, what does that look like? And that showed savings versus the case where the PPA expires and we add other generic resources.
And the real difference would be if you own, you put in 40 years, right? 40 years of life.
Correct.
And then it shows the benefits showing up in your bookends, which is what would be actually shown on figure or page 17, figure 1 and 2. Those would be your bookends. And your results are that we start seeing consistent savings sometime between 2031 and 2034.
Correct. That's what the modeling shows.
And those are your bookends.
That's right.
Okay. That's all the questions I have.
Mr. Pollan.
Thank you. Mr. Lean is back, and he's got a question. And his question is did Strategist tell you that early retirement of King and Sherco is a least cost solution?
So we did not evaluate that in this North Dakota modeling that was done. However, we have evaluated that in the IRP modeling. And if you look in the IRP document that's available, we did provide a table that shows PVRR results of the different baseload scenarios we ran. And you can see that the early coal retirement scenarios were lower cost than not the non-early retirement of coal cases.
Do you know how much? Or is that's just in, well, we can look that up.
Yep, exactly.
All right, nothing further. Thank you.
Commissioners, Commissioner Crocius.
Okay, thank you. Just one thing I want to make sure I'm clear on. So in the Strategist model, in your modeling, you didn't force in renewables for every scenario, correct?
In this modeling or in the IRP modeling, what are you referring to?
This modeling.
In this modeling? So, no. So we had the modified 2015 IRP scenario, which we did include. So we did force in some renewables because those had been included in our IRP, so they were just assumed to be included in that scenario, because mm-hmm. that's kind of what was approved coming out of the last resource plan. And then with the high renewable 85 by 30 case, that's where we did force in the renewables to make sure we hit that 85 by 30.
Okay, based on what you just said, though, to some degree, they were forced in.
To some degree, they were forced into both of those scenarios, in the modified 2015 IRP, there were less renewables forced in.
Okay, so less, but to some degree forced in on the one, significantly forced in on the 85 by 30 model.
Yes.
Fair enough to say?
Yes.
So how do you consider the modeling or the the results of the modeling truly accurate.
So I
at least to some degree manipulating the inputs, and that was covered by counsel as well earlier, but how do you find that accurate?
Sure. So I think our IRP modeling help kind of validate that approach. So again, we did a full optimization in the IRP modeling, and solar was selected as the least cost resource. So that's where we ended up with that 4,000 megawatts of solar additions from 25 to 35, and really did not, unless we imposed that firm dispatchable constraint, we didn't see any, you know, CT additions until further out in time. So I think that helped validate the fact that we added a lot of solar here. Yes, we forced it in, but the bulk of it would have been economic had we allowed the model to optimize.
And on the IRP, nothing was really forced in. It was just...
No, we tried to optimize everything and give it multiple options, even more so than we've done in the past. As I mentioned, we included those DSM supply-side options, so we really had a robust set of supply options that strategists had to select from.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, Commissioner Fedorchak.
Just a couple questions. So we've been talking about this capacity need in the mid-20s, and now you and Zev were talking about capacity and energy. Does the model show a need for capacity and energy
in the
mid-20s? Because otherwise a CT would fulfill the need, wouldn't it?
Sure. So, again, I think here, you know, we forced in a lot of solar, so you're getting the energy as must take from that resource. You know, I think out in the future, as retirements are occurring at our coal units, there's a void that materializes where we do have a need for the energy from these types of resources. And we looked up the capacity factor for Mankato that you had asked about earlier.
Mm-hmm.
And in the modified 2015 IRP case, we saw capacity factors for MEC in the like 40 to 50% range. And in the high renewables case, we saw capacity factors in the 30 to 40% range. So that kind of illustrates the impact that additional renewable, you know, minimized the opportunity for Mankato to mm-hmm. dispatch and serve energy needs.
And so for the 2019 IRP model, what impact would that have on the capacity and energy?
So I think we're adding less solar. So I would expect that our capacity factor is going to be in the same range. It's going to be probably in the 35 to 45% range because there's less solar, being jammed into the model. Now we're optimizing and the model's only selecting the amounts of solar that it deems economic.
And did it have the chance? How does it know the energy need? Did your inputs skew that at all?
Sure. So we, you know, strategist looks at, you know, total retail sales. We mm-hmm. we get a load forecast that's both a peak demand forecast and an energy forecast. So, you know, on an annual basis, we're looking at providing, you know, 40 to 45 million megawatt hours to serve all of our load on the NSP system. I think strategist does account for that. As it moves through each year, it looks at capacity needs, and it also looks at all of the resources we have on our system, and it's a production cost model, so it'll dispatch all of those resources to serve the energy requirements that we feed into it via the load forecast. So
okay.
it will make sure that all the energy needs are served to account for the energy need as well.
Okay. Can you, you mentioned to Zach that modeling on the coal units and their economics is in the IRP. Could you guys reference where? So if not now, just down the road, because I mean, yeah. 1,500 pages or whatever it is.
Fair enough. We'll get that in
I meant to ask you this the last time, PJ. So on page 14 of your direct, there's a table. It's just the regular page, not the appendix.
Correct.
It's table 6.
Okay.
OK, Can you just walk through that and explain what those numbers are?
Sure. So the 915 million, that is the capital cost of the Mankato purchase. So essentially, we're buying the facility, and the revenue requirements of owning that facility over the 40-year life amounts to 915.
Okay. So even though the purchase price was 650.
That's right. The purchase price is $650 million. However, for us to own the asset for 40 years, there's also O&M that's required. There's also incremental capital that's required to, maintain the unit and whatnot. So this represents the NPV of all of those costs over the 40-year life.
And it would include your earnings?
Correct. Yep.
Okay.
So the next line, the fixed savings of the Mankato PPA, basically that's the net present value of the avoided costs of terminating the PPA or ending the PPA.
Okay.
So if we were to keep the PPA, we'd pay $550 million in MPV costs through 2039 when MEC 2 ends. The fixed cost expansion plan costs are saving. These are savings here. By us adding the MEC acquisition, we're adding about a little over 300 megawatts of capacity from 2026 through 2039 by keeping MEC 1 on our books, and then also adding capacity beyond that until the retirement dates of 2046 and 54. So by adding that incremental capacity, we're displacing other capacity additions that would occur in the future, or deferring those capacity additions in the future and therefore saving money.
Does that come from a model someplace, the 365?
Yes, that comes from the model. And, basically you can see in expansion plans where CTs or other resources are getting deferred.
Okay.
So that's a good chunk of the savings.
The VOM.
VOM is just variable operation and maintenance cost.
Okay.
So because of the flexibility, so we have some more flexibility owning the resources versus some of the constraints of the PPA. So we anticipate that we'll be able to realize some VOM costs. Those are pretty small, though. And the rest of these are pretty small as well. Fuel cost. Here we have a higher fuel cost from ownership because we're running the owned resource more rather than buying from the market. So just paying for natural gas to run the unit instead of buying market energy results in some additional costs. But on the flip side, if you look at this market cost, so by buying the fuel and running the unit, we also save some money on the market side as well by reducing market purchases. And then lastly, PPA starts own start fuel costs. I think this also relates to the PPA versus ownership. There's more flexibility in our ownership versus the PPA had some constraints on start costs and whatnot, so we realize some savings there as well, but they're pretty small relative to some of the other categories.
Okay, $39 million.
Correct.
In savings. Okay, well, that's more than half of the estimated savings, so that's quite a lot. Tell me again where that comes from, that $39 million.
Sure. So every time the unit starts up, I think in the PPA we were paying a start charge to Southern, and I don't know exactly what the terms of that were. We could pull the PPA and talk through that if you would like, but I think generally we expect our start costs to be lower because the terms of the contract were less favorable than our ownership.
So that's a number that you could actually, it's not just a wild guess, there's a calculation there that came up with that.
Yeah, so I mean our energy supply folks and commercial ops folks had input into all of this, so they know that portion of this deal the best and could speak to that for sure.
Okay, all right, thank you. That's all my
Commissioner
questions.
Chrisman,
you used a term real early in your back and forth with Mr. Simser. What's a polar vortex? How do you define it?
So it was late January, there was a couple-day period where temperatures in the...
To be clear on the question, I'm familiar with what happened in late January, but what is a polar vortex?
I'm not a meteorologist, so I'm probably not the best person to explain exactly what a polar vortex is, but I lived through it, and it was when an extremely cold mass of air descended on the U.S. and temperatures dropped into, you know, very negative territory, and there were very high negative wind chills. And as a result, you know, we experienced some issues with some of our renewable production, you know, because there were many overcast days, sun's low in the winter, it was snowing, where solar output was minimal, and then we had icing conditions and low temperature conditions with some of our wind turbines where they had to shut down because it simply got too cold. So it's one of those extreme weather events that we have been using to help characterize that firm dispatchable need.
The result being that there wasn't as much energy on the system as there ought to have been?
Exactly, especially when looking specifically at renewables.
Okay, and so does something qualify as a polar vortex because the temperature hit a certain point on the thermometer, or because it was some level of cold and there wasn't enough energy?
Sure. So I think that's a good point. And in our discussions around the firm dispatchable, a lot of people have kind of raised issue with our firm dispatchable. And I think the February 5th date that we put forward and some of the net load challenges that we experienced on that day when it was not, you know, again, I don't know the specific definition of a polar vortex, but it was a more normal winter day where temperatures were, you know, 0 to 10 degrees, and we still experienced a renewable drought. So I think the point being that you don't necessarily need to have an extreme cold event for there to be issues with renewable serving load.
What do you call it on an extraordinarily hot day when there's not enough energy?
Sure. That would just be a peak day, in my opinion.
And so peak days in the summer and polar vortexes in the winter aren't really weather phenomenons. They're poor planning by energy operator phenomenons, correct?
So I wouldn't characterize it that way. You know, peak days in the summer are simply driven by load. You know, I am not aware of any blackouts or issues we've had in recent past on the NSP system where we have not been able to meet a peak summer load. You know, MISO dispatches the system and they look at load levels and they, you know, dispatch sufficient resources to meet load. So I don't know that we've had any issues under summer conditions like that. I think with the winter, historically folks have kind of disregarded the winter because our peak load in the summer is over 9,000 megawatts. Our peak load in the winter is about 7,000 megawatts. So, you know, again, we have, I think yesterday we discussed we have like 12 to 13,000 megawatts of nameplate resources on our system. So I think a lot of people look at that and they say you should have no problem meeting your winter peak because it's lower than your summer peak and you have all these resources available. But as we go to increasing levels of renewables that may not necessarily be available in the winter, and we have other resource restrictions like the Manitoba Hydro Diversity Exchange, you know, we provide them capacity in the winter. They provide us capacity in the summer, so we lose some of that resource in the winter. I think the winter is going to be more important as we move forward.
So you said a lot of people disregard important information. I said poor planning by energy system operators. I'm kind of taking that as a yes that I'm right.
I'm thinking of external audiences. In a utility, I would argue that we are not poor utility planners. We understand that we need to plan to meet peak loads both in the summer and the winter going forward, and that's part of why we're being proactive in the IRP and introducing this firm dispatchable requirement.
Well, I don't want to belabor it after this, but I said energy system operators. I didn't say NSP. And so as a whole, all the companies that make up the RTO, itself, regulators, there wasn't enough planning to make sure there was enough generation to meet the needs of a winter day. And the temperature wasn't really the issue. It was the amount of energy compared to the temperature, correct?
So, you know, I'm not aware of any outages that occurred during the polar vortex time frame. I know there were some supply issues and, you know, particularly like some gas supply issues and may have been some transmission constraints and other things. But, you know, we work with MISO. You know, MISO's primary responsibility is reliability of the system. So I think they're doing their best to plan for these conditions that they can.
Okay, enough about polar vortexes. Your rebuttal testimony on page 6 with the retirements. Throughout the break, I started having some questions on how these play out. I'll wait till you get there. And so I'm going to pick one as an example because I think it's easier to generalize than the other, and I'm talking about the accelerated closures. So the Ellen King plant, my understanding from the conversation this morning is there are about 18 or 19 years, almost two decades, of useful life and book value that needs to be recovered from that plant at this point in time, correct?
Correct.
And this plan cuts that about in half, correct?
Correct.
Okay, now, in order to recover, and your recovery includes O&M and fuel costs and the capital costs that went into it, correct?
That's correct.
Okay, so I'm only talking about the capital costs here now. Your recovery, if nothing changes from today, it just happens over the course of 18 or 19 years. Is that based on the megawatt hours sold, or how do you determine how much you recover each year?
In terms of how much we recover for the specific resource?
Yes.
So I think it's determined based on the revenue requirements for that particular year.
The whole company revenue requirements.
Right.
Okay. And so is it the company's plan, is part of what you're asking for in this ADP to up that revenue requirement now already and over the next roughly 9 years recover 18 years worth of capital costs on that? Or is that a separate question down the road of when you get to increase that recovery in order to make up those last 9 years?
Sure. So, again, I think we would be advocating for the addition of the Mankato resource with or without these early coal retirements. We've proposed these early retirements. They're not set in stone at this point. We haven't gotten any approvals from anyone yet.
Okay.
But we view Mankato as a valuable resource, whether these retire early or not.
And so what happens if, let's say, you get your approvals on Mankato, but you haven't been told that you're going to get additional recovery for these, and you decide to close Sherco and you get near or to the 20, I think I said Sherco, I meant Ellen S. King, the 2028 date, and the various jurisdictions say, no, you're not getting that, then would you continue to get recovery for those last 9 years, or is it just from that point on when it's no longer used and useful that the investors are out that amount of capital costs?
I think we'll have to weigh that decision when it's in front of us. You know, if we're not able to get recovery in our various jurisdictions, I think that would create a challenge and would be something we'd want to consider before advancing an early retirement.
Okay, but just to make sure I'm understanding in my mind, this commission, if it chose to grant advanced determination of prudence for MEC 1 and 2, that is not an assurance of increasing the enhanced or advanced recovery on these early closures, correct?
Yes, absolutely. We view Mankato as a separate standalone transaction.
Okay. And if an advanced determination is granted, That does that require you then, do you feel, to make this purchase, or is it still, do you seek these advanced determinations, and then when you would know that it's recoverable, you still have to make your business decision on whether or not to pull the string and purchase it?
I think the ADP approval would give us a lot of comfort in this jurisdiction to move forward. You know, even if there's a little bit of uncertainty potentially with the recovery through rate cases or any other mechanisms, you know, obviously there's other jurisdictions that we need approval from as well, so we need to weigh what happens in those also.
I didn't ask that in a very clear way. If you get an advanced determination from North Dakota and Minnesota, the only two jurisdictions where you ask for that,
right?
Could you still change your mind and say, you know, we rethought this and it's not as good a deal as we thought and we're not doing it? Or are you obligated because is this sort of an order from these two jurisdictions to purchase?
I don't know that it's an obligation, but I don't know why we wouldn't proceed forward. I think, again, we've laid out what I think is a pretty compelling case to acquire this asset. So I think if we got approval, we would move forward.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you.
I have a couple questions, and it's just something that's been talked about a lot. All this solar that's going to be acquired in this strategist profile, where would that solar be located? Is that known at this time?
Sure. So generic resources in our expansion plan, you know, generally we don't identify a specific location. You know, kind of the one exception to that in our recent modeling has been the Sherco combined cycle, just because of the reliability challenges there with retiring some of the existing coal. But all the solar we're proposing, you know, we assume that at some point in the future we'll do some sort of competitive solicitation and evaluate specific projects at that point in time.
Would that be solar you plan to own or solar that you plan to purchase by PPA?
I think it would be a combination. Our expectation is that we'd, you know, have to allow developers who want to offer PPAs to compete with any self-build or owned options that we would propose.
And a typical solar location, you have an ideal megawattage for these CC units. What would be an ideal solar location?
In terms of size?
Yeah.
So we've seen projects out there ranging from 50 to 200 megawatts in the region. You know, I've heard of some other projects elsewhere in the U.S. that could be larger, but generally I think we're anticipating 50 to 200 megawatts per project.
Is it practical to locate 250 megawatts of solar at a location where you're shutting down 250 megawatts of something else because there's already transmission lines available?
That's definitely under consideration, and with some of the transmission challenges that you're referencing, you know, I think we'll look for opportunities to squeeze every ounce out of the existing transmission system that we can without triggering new transmission lines.
Okay. That's all I have. Mr. Simpson, do you have any follow-up to the last round?
I don't.
Okay. Mr. Armstrong?
No.
Mr. Pelham?
Nothing further. Thanks.
Commissioners?
No.
Nothing.
Okay. You can step down, Mr. Martin. Mr. Simpson, where do we go next?
Applicant Resitz Direkis, reserving the right to recall witnesses.
Okay. Mr. Armstrong, you ready to go, or do you want to? It's 2 o'clock. We can go for about an hour. Do you want to start with the witness? Or
my witness just took a little leave of the room, so.
Oh, okay, to start with Mr. Alvarez?
Yeah.
Okay, then let's come back at 2:10.
Okay.
I know that there's some planes that guys have to catch, too, so we want to keep it moving. Oh, he's back.
There he is.
Anybody need a 5 or 10 minute break?
I don't.
No?
Looks like.
Let's keep going.
The attorney's already left the room, Your Honor.
Zev left.
Okay. Okay, 2:05. We're still on the record here, so I'm going to mute the mic. Oh, that's all right.
So this is.
Back on the record, 2:08 p.m. Mr. Armstrong?
Advocacy staff calls Paul Alvarez.
Okay, Mr. Alvarez, you were here when I read the perjury admonition.
I was.
Have you raised your right hand? Do you promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
I do.
Thank you. Mr. Armstrong?
I just want to check, is your green light on your mic there?
Mics. Yeah.
You were on.
Yeah.
There you go.
It's blue.
Okay. That's better. Okay. Just state your name for us, please.
Paul Alvarez.
And are you the same Paul Alvarez who prepared the pre-filed testimony in
I
this
am.
Case? And if I were to ask you those same questions today, would your answers remain the same?
They would.
Okay. Can you briefly summarize for us your testimony and recommendations?
I think my testimony makes three primary points. The first point being that the NSP's recommendation to obtain an advanced determination of prudence for the Mankato purchase is based on a demand, peak demand growth, which is probably unlikely. I mean, it's a reversal of prior trends, and my observations are that the trend will accelerate. The falling demand will accelerate, not moderate. The second point is that the generation forecast is unduly pessimistic. And including a lot of plant closures, as we've discussed quite a bit today. And then finally, the idea that we should be incurring certain rate increases now for potential benefits long in the future is probably not a worthwhile choice. And in fact, in a previous case before this commission, which was the ADP proceeding for the Mankato 2 PPA. This commission, in my opinion, correctly decided that trade-off was not worth it. And so that's a summary of my testimony, my recommendation being that the ADP not be approved.
And you've been present throughout the hearing today?
I have.
And even prior to your testimony, you've reviewed NSP's pre-filed rebuttal as well as listened to their witnesses' testimony
yes.
today? And has that testimony changed your opinions at all?
No.
Thank you. I tender Mr. Alvarez for cross.
Okay, Mr. Simser, cross-examination.
You summarized your testimony as saying that the company's generation forecast was unduly pessimistic. What exactly does that mean?
Just the example I cited in testimony was the idea that the nuclear plants would close and not be extended. And I felt that was just as one example, given that they are a clean resource, and I understand that is an objective to have emissions-free generation, that was unlikely to happen.
So you've been involved in resource planning for your career, correct?
On and off, yes.
On and off, okay. And you've heard Mr. Martin's testimony today, and I think you've been through the list on Mr. Martin's page 5 and 6 of his rebuttal, which we've talked about ad nauseum, quite frankly, today. Mm-hmm. Is that fair?
Yes.
And from your view of this pessimism, would it at least be fair to say that of the 3,500 megawatts coming offline between the mid-2020s and the 2030s that the company has said that you find pessimistic, let's say at least 600 is a certainty?
I think it depends on the time frames. Certainly at some point, yes. But I think there's a question as to the timing of those closures.
Do you think Blue Lake Units 1 through 4 will not close in 2023?
I haven't rendered an opinion on that. I think there's certainly potential to extend them further. I feel like that's a determination that NSP has made that may or may not be the case in reality.
And what do you base your opinion that there's potential to extend them further? Have you requested discovery? Have you performed any analysis from that perspective?
Not in that particular facility, no.
Okay. Is it true that the Cottage Grove Combined Cycle Energy Center contract will expire in 2027?
It's true as far as I know.
Okay. So that wouldn't be pessimistic to say that at least 233 megawatts of capacity will roll off the system in 2027?
Well, I would say it's pessimistic to assume that it won't be renewed.
Well, if 233 megawatts of generation are rolling off the system, one would assume, unless something materially changes, that they're likely to be replaced, no?
But there are many options with which to replace that, right?
That's exactly the point, isn't it? I mean, there's 233 megawatts that were under contract that will no longer be under contract that will need to be replaced somehow.
That's a true statement.
It could
yes.
be a PPA extension.
Could be.
It could be the world's biggest battery.
Could be.
It could be a combustion turbine in Iowa, quite frankly.
Agreed.
No? Yeah, okay. You testify that the free market will ensure the availability of future capacity. In general, would you agree that as the need for capacity grows, the cost of capacity increases in the capacity markets?
Repeat that for me, the end of that?
Sure. If the free market, you argue the free market will ensure that capacity will be available, right?
Yes.
Because when there's money to be made, somebody will go try and make the money, correct?
That's my point, yes.
Yes. And fundamentally, the cost of that capacity will follow the general rules of supply and demand.
Yes.
Okay. And so as capacity needs increase, because there's not sufficient supply, the price will increase, correct?
That's correct.
And over time, more capacity will be added to chase the higher price, bringing down the price of capacity over time.
All of the things held constant, yes.
Okay. Did you conduct any analysis on future baseload retirements within MISO or the timing of such retirements?
No.
Okay. So from you have never looked to see what the capacity needs within the MISO footprint are going to be, correct?
No.
Okay. Would you agree that given the NSP's at least announced retirements listed in Mr. Martin's testimony that there is likely to be an increased capacity need within MISO in the next decade?
I have not analyzed that question.
Okay. But based on the announced retirements, let's call it 2,000 megawatts of need, just assume, that would increase need. I mean, Xcel is about 10% of MISO, no?
Again, assuming all other things being equal.
Yeah, okay, that's fine. You also cite the PJM capacity market in support of your claim that the markets will ensure the availability of future capacity, correct?
Yes.
Isn't it true that PJM capacity markets had a clearing price well over 150 megawatts a day in recent years? $150 per megawatt day in recent years?
I believe that's probably correct.
Okay, and do you believe $150 per megawatt day is a reasonable price for NSP customers?
Well, I think if you look at the PJM price trend in history, it's volatile. It happens to be $150 now. It has been as low as $70, $80. And so while $150 might be a high price to pay, it won't always be $150.
Oh, and so and at the end of the day, it's, well, in PJM, they have a non-vertically integrated market. So it's not necessarily customers who are covering that, correct?
Well, the customers have to cover those costs eventually.
Eventually, okay.
Yes.
So you think that it would make sense for NS? Well, there's no similar capacity market construct in MISO, is there?
Not today.
Not today. And right now, MISO has an annual auction, essentially, correct?
Yes.
And the auction is clearing at pretty low levels, correct?
That's correct.
But per our previous discussion, as capacity tightened, you would expect that the price would increase, correct?
Assuming all else remains equal, yes.
Okay. And so if I'm understanding you correctly, really the company should never seek to replace any of its resources. It should just always purchase in the capacity market. Is that correct?
No, that's not correct.
Why is that not correct?
Well, as Mr. Martin's testimony suggests, there are many ways to secure capacity, and a diversified portfolio is probably the way to go.
Okay. So you would at least support the company having a diversified portfolio?
Yes.
That diversity would include nuclear, combined cycles, and combustion turbines?
PPAs, some spot purchases as necessary, yes.
Company ownership of items?
Sure.
Renewable energy?
Sure.
And quite frankly, experimental projects, batteries and other storage just to test the market?
Sure, some R&D.
Okay.
Reasonable.
And there's nothing from that statement that would alleviate the need to, or would alleviate the rationale to go ahead and add to the diversity of his portfolio by purchasing this combined cycle facility, correct?
Can you repeat that question?
Sure. You just testified that there is value to NSP having a diversified portfolio, correct?
Correct.
And purchasing the MAC facility would help add to that diversity, no?
Still natural gas fueled, so maybe less diversity addition than some other resources, but to a moderate degree, yes.
Yes, and it would add to the diversity of ownership versus contracted, correct?
I'm not familiar with the exact portfolio mix right now, so I couldn't I couldn't comment on that.
So do you think it might then be reasonable to lock in the capacity prices today rather than risk what the market may bring into the future?
Well, as my testimony suggests, there's pros and cons to that. You are paying more today for uncertain benefits in the future, so it's kind of a perspective policy question.
And that really goes back to having a diversified portfolio, correct?
I'm sorry, which part are you referring to goes back?
Sure. You said you're paying more today for uncertain benefits in the future, but aren't you also paying a little bit more today for hedging uncertain risks of the future as well?
Through diversification?
No, through purchasing the MEC facility.
Yes.
And I guess that's all we're trying to say is that I guess my question to you is that diversification helps manage the hedging of the risk, capturing the benefits of the future and managing the risks of the future.
But it could also be more costly. Yes, I would agree with that statement, but it could also be more costly.
Okay. And that's a question of prudence. Would a reasonable person make that bet today or not? And that's what we're asking the commission to decide, correct?
That's correct.
Okay. In your testimony, you argue that the only reason Southern would sell the MEC facility now is because it has concluded demand will fall and the plant will never be worth more than it is now. Do you stand by that statement?
I do.
And there's nothing in Mr. Martin's rebuttal testimony that would persuade you to reconsider the fact that Southern has other needs for cash desperately nowadays?
Yeah, I guess that could also be true.
So it's not necessarily the only reason?
I'd say it's a very primary reason.
Okay. And you've done research into Southern's underlying rationale for the sale? You've talked to Southern or you've talked to research analysts?
I have not.
No. So it's just based on your analysis of what?
Popular press, industry press accounts of what's happening with Volkdol and their capital needs.
And their okay. So you do concur that at least the popular press has shown that Southern needs to raise some capital pretty quickly, correct?
Sure.
Okay. Thank you. Nothing further.
Mr. Pelham.
Mr. Alvarez, I understand your testimony is that ADP is not prudent, and you believe that it's more prudent to wait for resource planning processes in the late 2020s or early 2030s to examine the need for additional capacity. Okay. But do you see any risk involved with waiting?
Sure, there's risk involved with waiting, and there's risk involved with acting now.
Sure, and what would you say some of the risks are in waiting?
I think the risk involved is probably the one cited in Mr. Martin's testimony, which is there's a potential that the prices will be higher in the future. My understanding or my observations lead me to believe that it won't be the case.
Sure.
But it's certainly a possibility.
And you'd agree with me, the observations in the testimony filed of yourself as well as Mr. Martin and others is based on estimates, is based on past precedent, right?
Yes.
Okay. And one of the areas that that you provided in your direct testimony was the demand of capacity and energy is going to decrease in the future. And that's what
yes.
you provided. Okay. I'm just wondering if in your analysis, if you looked at did you account for population changes in the NSP service areas?
No.
Okay. Do you think that that would be something that would have value in making a determination as to the demand for future capacity and demand?
I think potentially. I don't see large changes in the population. Doesn't seem like a big impact to me. I would argue that a lot of the technology changes we're seeing are going to have a much greater impact relative to current situation than population change.
All right. Thank you, sir. I don't have any other questions for you.
Questions from the commissioners. Chairman Crocius.
Just a few. Thank you, Your Honor. I had, with both of the company witnesses referred to, their need for new or additional capacity as self-inflicted.
Mm-hmm.
Would you agree with that to a small degree, moderate, large degree?
A strong degree.
Strong degree. So looking at your analysis, it would be a net savings of 20, not realized by ratepayers until 2042.
I agree with Mr. Majoros's analysis of that, yes.
Okay. And that doesn't include the additional cost, which I think everyone just about, at least on this side of the room and at the bench, has referred to in some way, shape, or form. The early retirements, the added burden to ratepayers to pick up the undepreciated portion of those assets.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. So would that push the date from 2042, and maybe this is a question to be redirected, but does that change 2042 to 2045 or 2050 even?
It could. I believe it could.
So we're talking about potentially 3 decades before there's actually a net savings to justify the additional capacity or perceived need for additional capacity when at the same time the company is retiring facilities or not aggressively renegotiating PPAs.
I agree.
Okay, I don't have any other questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Hi there. So you're pessimistic about their demand growth figures.
Yes.
Talk about that a little bit more. Why do you question them?
Well, if you look at the last 10 years, you know, demand per customer has fallen.
Mm-hmm.
I see no reason why that would change. I think it'll continue to fall. And again, my observations are that if any change is likely in that trend, it's likely going to accelerate rather than moderate or even reverse, which is what the demand curve in this case was presented as.
And I don't know what's behind their demand numbers, but what about with electrification? Electric cars,
yeah.
More. I mean, I don't see it as viable in the upper Midwest, but there's a lot of talk nationwide about getting rid of, you know, gas home heating and going to electrification that way.
Yeah, I think it's very regional, as far as certainly for the electrification of heating. You know, climates are different. Some climates, you know, what do they call the heat exchangers, won't keep up, you know, with how cold it gets. And so I don't know how big an impact that's going to be. I think my testimony covers a little bit about electrification and that a lot of people are counting on electric vehicles to increase demand. I think there are studies that indicate that, and I've cited those in testimony, that the growth is not going to be as great as people think. There are electric vehicles are more efficient, first of all, in transferring energy to miles. That's certainly one issue. I think there are also people who say the automation of driving is going to reduce the energy use, you know, rather than all the stoplights and starting and stopping and traffic that we have, that the, you know, applications are going to take over and make things a lot more efficient in terms of, you know, where cars go and how they get to their destinations and wasted energy on the way. And so when you take all those accounts into consideration, all those factors into consideration, I think there are studies that show that electrification will be responsible for some growth. Will it be enough to offset the reductions from efficiency and demand response and solar and increasing storage adoption by customers? I think it's going to be kind of a maybe a wash even.
And are they counting on that in their demand?
Well, yeah, as I point out in the in my testimony, they seem to take into account things that will grow demand, like electrification, but not so much the solar and storage. So things that will reduce, you know, demand. Certainly, they do take into account. I give them credit for taking into account their energy efficiency programs, their demand response programs. But, you know, additional efficiency and demand reductions will occur beyond those programs just by customer initiative. And so I think, again, they over-accentuate in their estimates those things that grow load and underestimate those things that reduce load.
Okay. And then one other question, and this is not an argument the company's making, but it's an argument that we've heard from other companies, and that in replacement of gas purchasing gas generation or pursuing it, and that is that it's more cost effective, even considering the cost of retiring some of the facilities early and paying for those costs. It's still more efficient to pursue the natural gas resource. Are you seeing, if that was the case here, would you have a different opinion? Like if the company had proven or had showed that, you know, Sherco, King, Sherco 1, 2, and King, I know they keep saying that that's not what drove this, but it's hard to ignore the loss of that capacity at just about the same time that they need it.
Right. It would certainly be easier if I had that analysis to agree with that, yes. If the company had presented that analysis and it indicated, as you suggest, that this is the lowest cost approach, yes, it would have been easier for me to make that.
And by not having that, should we assume that it isn't the lowest cost approach?
If it were me and I had something like that that I could show, I would show it.
Yeah. Okay, no more questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Christman.
I want to try and correlate two pieces of testimony. Your testimony on page 12, and it's been discussed here quite a bit today about how long it will be until this turns positive financially. And then do you have a copy of Mr. Martin's direct testimony in front of you?
I do.
Go to page 22, please.
Okay.
So here it seems to flip in just a few years. So, although, I mean, in testimony, he has kind of acknowledged your numbers to some extent, but what does this table mean compared to what you're saying?
Well, I think this table is based on the analysis the company's prepared, which includes a certain amount of demand growth and generation retirement. And those are exactly the assumptions that I'm calling into question. And so I think that's the disconnect, is a disagreement on those issues.
But then okay, now I see the answer to my subsequent question. So I got that. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Then just a few pages later on your testimony on page 23, and you mentioned this in your opening comments. Thank you for the compliment on our March of 2016 decision on...
You're welcome.
...on not approving that ADP. But at some point, something that might eventually be a good idea. At some point, it's premature. At another point, it's mature. So it's not like if this pen quits writing, let's go grab another one. And so I don't have to plan in advance. Energy generation takes advanced planning. Engineering, land acquisition, construction.
Yes, prudence. Certainly.
At what point could we conclude that while, yes, I am delighted to agree with you that at that time that proposal was premature, but perhaps at this time it's close enough to mature that it is time to go forward with
mm-hmm,
it?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it comes down to lead time that you mentioned. It's certainly not 15 years, right? And we have a lot of facilities that are already permitted and in place that we could upgrade. We could, you know, there's a lot of things we can do with them. There's a lot of capacity out there right now. If a PPA expires, the plant that formerly supported that PPA is still there. Right, so you know there are resources out there. I think the question becomes: let's just say you say worst case scenario, if you needed new construction, it would be 5 years. Then I think that's about the time to start worrying. Is when you're 6 years out and it appears that you might have some problems. But 15 years out, I would argue is too far.
In the business world, though, aren't there times when you have to acknowledge just the fact that something is for sale now, may or may not be later, and take advantage of those opportunities? I come from the ag world,
yeah.
And if I were to only have ever bought land when I needed it, it never would have been for sale at the right time.
Right.
So,
right.
How do we build that? How do we take that into proper consideration?
I mean, that is the challenge that you all are faced with. And I think it basically comes down to what is the preponderance of the evidence? You know, if you had to guess which way demand is going to go in the future, given what we're seeing and how fast prices are coming down for solar and how fast prices are coming down for storage, you know, 15 years is a long time. And so, yes, you have to take advantage of opportunities when you see them. But those opportunities are based on predictions of what's going to happen in the future. And I think we all have to make, unfortunately for you, the best guess you can as to which condition is more likely, you know? And I think that's that's what you have to go on. And I think so far, as I mentioned in my testimony, the trends are demand is going to continue to fall. And I think, just based on what I've seen, even just in the last week, it's going to fall faster in the future than it has in the past.
Mr. Martin's rebuttal, do you have that?
Yes.
Page 3.
Yes.
And here's where, I don't know, my instinct is, this is one where I tend to sure agree with him, so I need you to refute it down. The last answer, starting on line 24, having to do with looking at a different term for a PPA as opposed to ownership of something. Do you completely disagree with them on that, or is there some level of disagreement that you have with that?
Unfortunately, again, I have to plead it.
Oh, I'm sorry. This was in response to Mr. Majors.
It is, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, I have to.
I'll wait with the question.
Yeah.
Darn, I didn't need the signal to him what the question was going to be. Okay. Thank you, sir. I have no other questions.
Commissioner Fedorchik has one more question.
So on the in Mr. Martin's direct testimony on page 14 of the appendix, which is table 10, we talked about this quite extensively during his testimony.
Yes, I have it here.
I think you would be the one to answer this, but maybe it's Mr. Majors, but you know, looking at this comparison, it does appear that the MEC units are a good buy. Do you disagree?
I think the question is compared to what and in what circumstances, you know. So we currently have PPAs in place. Again, do we need this capacity, or is it because of retirements and demand forecast that we think we need this capacity? And then how do you know when you're buying it now, although the price might be right, that it's the right decision? You mentioned earlier, maybe now's the time we should be considering or favoring leasing over buying. I would say, given the dynamics of the environment and how rapidly things are changing, that's a really good point. I can't answer it for you definitively. Mm-hmm. And by some comparisons here, maybe the price per megawatt is reasonable, but that's not the question. The question is, how does it compare to the PPAs? And do we need that power in 15 years?
Okay, thank you.
All right, Mr. Armstrong.
No questions.
Mr. Simpson.
No questions.
Mr. Pelham.
No questions, thank you.
Mr. Lean, you're leaning in, no? Okay. Anything else from the commissioners?
No questions from me.
Okay. Mr. Alvarez, you may step down. Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Armstrong.
You left everything up there, right? Yep. Okay. Call Mike Majors, Jr.
Okay, Mr. Majors, you were here this morning, and you've been here all day, and I gave the perjury admonition this morning, so I'll ask you to raise your right hand. You promise to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth in this proceeding?
Yes, I do.
Thank you. Go ahead, Mr. Armstrong.
Thank you. Mr. Majoros, could you just state your name for us, please?
Michael J. Majoros, Jr.
And are you the same Mr. Majoros that filed pre-filed testimony in this case?
Yes.
And if I were to ask you the same questions today, would you provide the same answers as provided in your pre-filed testimony?
Yes.
Could you briefly summarize for us your testimony and recommendations?
Yes. My testimony explains why, based on my analysis, the proposed acquisition is not prudent from the customer's perspective and, in fact, is not prudent from the company's perspective. The $650 million cost is excessive and unreasonable. In addition, Xcel has not even entertained the possibility of reducing its current PPA payments to account for the huge tax reduction that took place in 2018. Xcel admits that such a renegotiation is possible, but it hasn't done that. In order to rationalize the $650 million purchase price, the company ran a few net present value summaries. Assuming the continuation of the PPA versus purchase of Mankato, because the net present value of the buy streams were less than the continue PPA streams, Mr. Martin determined that the purchase was economic and therefore prudent. The problem is that his calculations included assumptions that resulted in a self-fulfilling prophecy. They were designed to produce the results that they filed. Notwithstanding all of that, here are a few facts. Xcel has not provided a projection of costs as required by the statute. It has merely provided a projection of the purchase price. Xcel has not provided the original cost of Mankato. Original cost is the standard upon which all rate making is based. It was established back in the 1930s in the Public Utility Holding Company Act that resulted from utilities buying wealthy people buying little municipals, depreciating them, and then selling them to each other and writing them back up to depreciate them again. And that involved Mr. Insull, who was, I think, the board of directors on the chairman of the board of Commonwealth Edison. So, in order to know, I conclude at page 7 and 8 of my testimony that the company intends to record a major acquisition adjustment. An acquisition adjustment is an amount of cost that exceeds the original cost of a utility plant. And that emanated from the Public Utility Holding Company Act of 30s. In order to know the correct amount of the acquisition adjustment, we must know the original cost of Mankato. The Mankato Energy Center was built by Calpine and owned, and Calpine sold all the power from Mankato to Xcel until, so this is an important point, So even though Mankato and even though Calpine were in the so-called non-regulated world, they sold into the regulated industry, and the cost that they charged under those PPAs were utility costs. And because they were utility costs, Calpine was supposed to maintain and keep track of and identify the original cost of Mankato. And the original cost is defined in the USOA, and it's just the heart of rate making. The original cost is the cost when the asset is first devoted to public utility service. So, based on what we're seeing now, I'm speculating a little here, but I believe that it's quite possible that Calpine built a big acquisition adjustment into its sale of the original Mankato to Southern Company. Now, Southern Company bought that and apparently only recorded the purchase price and never kept track of the original cost, even though it was selling into a regulated market and the requirement for the identification and maintenance of original cost existed. Excel tells us today none of those numbers exist. Southern Company had an Calpine had an obligation to maintain those numbers. Southern Company had an obligation to maintain them. And Excel, if it buys, has an obligation to maintain and report those numbers. And in this case, it is obvious from what they filed and told me that they want to put the $650 million purchase into rate base. Now, it's a fact that the purchase power contracts themselves, I think, at least one of them, is in rate base according to their Form 1. Now, Excel's proposal front loads the Mankato purchase onto ratepayers before any potential savings begin. The Mankato purchase with Excel's 85 by 30 plan will initially cause increases to ratepayers, and ratepayers don't break even until 2042. Mr. Martin relies on those savings to justify his claims regarding the 85 by 30 plan. The existing PPA for Mankato 1 is included, as I just stated, included in Excel's rate base, and it is reasonable to assume, as I just said, they will attempt to put the purchase in rate base. The existing PPA, Mankato PPAs, were calculated before the tax cuts that just happened a couple of years ago, the big tax cuts, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. And that, to me, that means those higher corporate tax rate means that the existing PPAs are excessive. I mean, we were talking about sort of business issues earlier today, and that would be my first thought. When the tax rates went down so much, I would have gone in and tried to renegotiate every PPA I had, because that was a significant, it's not a minor type of issue, it's a big issue, big numbers involved. So excessive PPA payments make the proposed purchase seem more reasonable. The higher the PPA costs, The company acknowledges that it is possible to restructure a current PPA due to a change in the tax rate, but they didn't even consider doing that. The strategist model status quo scenario, this is for kind of future reference here, replaces the lost energy from a different resource in the company's portfolio or market purchases whatever is cheaper. So the entire justification is Mr. Martin's net present value treatment analyses, and he used 6.53% to which is a weighted average cost of capital across NSPS system, the company's system. But that 6.53 does not reflect the company's customers' discount factor. So the reason I raised that is because the entire, regardless of all of the engineering issues that we discussed, that was just discussed, the company brought to you a request for pre-approval and said, our filing demonstrates this is good for customers. That our filing, which contains these net present value calculations, proves our case. Nothing else, as far as I'm concerned. And it doesn't prove their case. Now, as I said, the customer's discount factor, it's higher. What I took into account, I thought it was a 17% average credit card rate, and that's an average of higher rates for poorer people and probably lower rates for wealthier people. That's the average rate, and it's reported by the federal government. And then I weighted that. I used that for residentials and small business because I can tell you my small business has a higher interest rate, I mean, than 6.53%. So, and then I retained the company 6.53% for its demand customers, which are big, big companies. Using that, just considering it, there are no customer savings associated with the 85 by 30 plan. If you consider the customer's discount rate, which also considers the company's discount rate. So I assume we're here because we're concerned about the impact of this purchase on its ratepayers. And that's why it's reasonable to consider the customer's discount rate. I conclude the Mankato purchase is not economic. The purchase price is too high, and the existing PPA payments are too high, too. Rather than making this uneconomic purchase, the company could reasonably renegotiate the PPAs to try and drive them down for the tax rate cuts and not purchase a plant which it knows far exceeds the original cost of that plant. Far exceeds, and they know it. And the reason they know it is because Mr. Martin admitted it or told us so in his rebuttal testimony. Now, should I go on?
No, I just have one other question for you, Ms. Majoros, and I would just ask if you could. I don't know if you can tell if it's picking him up, but when he leans back, I can't hear him as much. If you could try to stay close to the microphone so we can make sure it records you.
I have a big stomach.
Project pretty well.
I wanted to ask you about one thing in Mr. Martin's rebuttal testimony, and that was he testified that the time frame you used in your economic analysis unreasonably undervalued the Met facility. Could you explain your response to that? He used the 40 years, and then you evaluated it through the expiration of the PPAs. Is that correct?
Yes. And my analysis, I did a couple of different analyses, and they were all using the company's numbers and their assumptions. And so my analysis that you're talking about now used the end point of the MEC 2 PPA as the end point of the analysis. And I did that because I assumed that's reality. That's kind of the starting point of an economic analysis. So I don't think it's unreasonable.
I'll tender Mr. Majoros for cross.
Okay. Mr. Simpson, cross-examination.
Thank you. Mr. Majoros, it seems to me that you base a fair amount of your testimony on a lack of knowing what the acquisition adjustment is. Is that correct?
No, I base a large amount of my testimony on the fact that the company has not filed original cost numbers, which it should have done, and it should have. This morning, Mr. Martin, I think, said Southern Company came to Excel and said, we want to sell this plant to you for $650 million. And he says, because they need the money, he said, okay. If he had asked for, I mean, it's common good business in the utility industry to ask for the original cost numbers. So what I'm the point I'm trying to make about the acquisition adjustment is that I speculated that there was going to be an acquisition adjustment. I just couldn't tell how much. Mr. Martin has quantified about $100 million that they didn't tell you before, but they will attempt to put in rate base and amortize, and that's a fact. And that's the in my opinion, that's the minimum amount. If we ever get the original cost numbers, we might find out it's a lot more.
Well, did you request calculation of the acquisition adjustment in discovery before you filed?
I didn't know about the. I just speculated.
You just speculated that there was an acquisition adjustment.
That there was going to be one. Yeah.
And the company never provided you any information in discovery that that it was going to book an acquisition adjustment.
No. And I asked over and over again for the original cost numbers.
May I approach, Your Honor?
Yes, you may.
This is information request number 2-14. That was tendered by Mr. Majoros to the company. If you look at the attachment to that.
You have a copy.
I don't have an extra copy, no. I'll give counsel a minute.
Yeah, why don't you tender it to counsel and let Mr. Armstrong take a glance at
it? Sounds good.
I can follow along with your questions if you want. Now that I have in front
okay.
of me.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Now that that discovery request that DR was issued prior to filing of your direct testimony. Is that correct, Mr. Majoros?
That's correct.
And in that data response, the company provided you with its acquisition adjustment, including its entire its entire proposed journal entries prior to you filing your direct testimony. The attachment to that IR is those journal entries, correct?
Yes.
So prior to filing your testimony here, you did at least have the company's calculation of its proposed acquisition adjustment, correct?
Yeah, but it wasn't based on original cost.
Well, it was based on the company's understanding of original cost. Company believed or estimated that Southern Company's cost or the original cost of the facility is.
No. Number B. You know, I don't recall seeing that, but maybe I did. Maybe I did when I wrote my testimony. And if I'd seen it, I would have said, not based on original cost. Item B, I said, please provide the original cost of MEC 1 and MEC 2 facilities at the account and subaccount level according to the FERC USOA as of 12/31/18, as well as the estimated changes through June 2019. Quote, original cost as applied to electric plant means the cost of such property to the person first devoting it to public service. End quote. And that's FERC definition 23.
And will you read the company's response to that subpart?
Sure. Yeah, I'm dying to hear it.
This should be an exhibit as well.
I think it's a good idea.
Yeah, we'll enter it in.
Excel prepared accounting entries based on the net book value of MEC's property, plant, and equipment as of September 30th, 2018, and taking into consideration the estimated remaining project cost associated with MEC 2 and additional assets to be acquired through May 31st, 2019. Please refer to Attachment A, which Excel does not possess MEC 1 and MEC 2 facilities account and subaccount level accounting according to the FERC Uniform System of Accounts.
So you asked for that information, and we told you we didn't have it. Is that correct?
That's right.
And we gave you our best estimate based on GAAP accounting that of the information that we had available. Is that correct?
Yeah.
And
I don't know. First of all,
Before we go any further, let's mark that as Exhibit 14.
That's fine by me.
Okay. And if you want to describe it for the record, it's in the
That would be Excel Energy's response to information request number 2-14.
And then if you'll offer it.
Offered?
Yeah. No objection.
No objection.
Okay, that'll be admitted. Exhibit 14 is in evidence.
That's the one.
And you can hand me up a copy at some point.
Okay. Would you, Mr. Majoros, would you agree that both the Mankato Energy Center LLC, which is the LLC owning MEC 1, and Mankato Energy Center 2 LLC, which is the LLC owning MEC 2, sell wholesale power and services at market-based rates and are therefore not required to file quarterly or annual Form 1 or Form 3s, respectively?
Yes.
Okay. And so there would be no FERC Form 1 or Form 3 accounts available for us to give you the information of the original cost based on how you phrase your question. Would that be fair?
No.
Why not?
Because your company is a public, your client is a public utility. They well know the requirements of the USOA, notwithstanding the fact that they're selling in at market prices. They're selling power to public utility customers. That's public utility service. And if I am shocked and dismayed by the fact that they don't have these original cost numbers. That's negligence as far as I'm concerned.
Okay. Can you point to me the FERC regulations and rules that would require LLCs such as Mankato Energy Center and Mankato Energy Center 2 to file the FERC Form 1s or Form 3s?
No. This company is fully aware, as a result of the Public Utility Holding Company Act, that the original cost concept does not go away, I don't believe, when you build a merchant plant, because you're still providing public utility service.
Well, would you agree that to the extent you have an acquisition adjustment, FERC would require NSP to record it on its books?
If you had an acquisition adjustment.
If there was an acquisition adjustment for this purchase, wouldn't FERC Uniform System of Accounts require that to be accounted for separately on NSP's books?
Yes.
Yes.
And you're going to propose to put the whole purchase into rate base. You're going to put the whole purchase in, at a total cost of $650 million.
Well, my question was, from an accounting standard, is NSP required to separately account for the acquisition adjustment on its books according to the Uniform System of Accounts?
Yes.
And are you familiar with FERC's requirements as to how to calculate that acquisition adjustment?
And you just said to me that these are merchant plants operating in an unregulated world, but you calculated an acquisition adjustment.
That's actually not what I just said to you. What I asked you was a very simple question. Are you familiar with FERC's requirements as to how to calculate and record an acquisition adjustment of this kind?
Yes or no?
Yes.
And what are those requirements?
I believe it's the excess over net book value.
And if net book value is not available, does FERC allow you to estimate what you believe the net book value of the plant is to properly record an acquisition adjustment?
Estimate what the original cost is.
The original cost depreciated, sir.
I think so.
Yeah.
The original cost. Original cost.
Yeah, original cost.
That's the standard.
I don't disagree with you, but what you're saying is that the company did not provide you original cost, correct?
That's right.
But the company did provide you a journal entry consistent with the FERC Uniform System of Accounts.
No, it didn't.
On what basis, sir?
It's not original cost.
But FERC Uniform System of Accounts, you just agreed, allows you to estimate the original cost, and this is the company's estimation.
They didn't estimate the original cost, as far as I'm concerned, but maybe they did.
Okay, so maybe they did. And you asked this question in discovery, and we provided you the acquisition adjustment. You asked no follow-up discovery, to my knowledge, and you sought no further investigation into the basis for our estimated cost, nor the basis for our calculation of our acquisition adjustment. Is that correct?
No.
Okay.
I predicted you were going to record an acquisition adjustment.
Yes, you did.
An acquisition adjustment is an amount of money over and above the original cost of the asset.
I point you to page 7 of your testimony, the sentence beginning with I on line 13 through the end of that sentence. Can you please read that for me, sir?
I'm at page 7.
Line 13, the sentence starting with I, ending at the end of line 14.
I conclude that 2039 is the proper endpoint for PPA cost comparison.
Page 7, sir.
I'm looking at page 7. Oh.
He's reading the wrong one. He's reading the line.
Oh, the line is wrong?
Yeah, oh. That he's read.
Yes. Starting at line 13. Oh.
Okay. Same page, just two lines down.
Just two lines down.
I conclude that two lines down.
I conclude. I also conclude.
Line 13. I also conclude. Right. I also conclude that the company expects to record a significant acquisition adjustment, but has not provided the anticipated amount.
Thank you. Moving on, you also raised some concerns with respect to the fact that the company did not renegotiate the PPA when the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act was passed. Is that correct?
Yes.
And your concerns are that Calpine or Southern Company, whoever owns it, should give NSP a discount because that the then owner of the plant is making too much money under the PPAs. Is that correct?
Would you say that again,
please? Sure. I think your theory of the case is that the owner of the Mankato Energy Center is making too much money under the PPAs now that they have a tax cut, so they should give that money back to NSP. Is that correct?
No. What I'm saying is NSP ought to try and get that money back.
Well, you know, we've had some discussion today that NSP is now trying to go buy the plant. Buying the plant would get that money back.
How would it?
Sure.
But there's at least $100 million excess built into this whole thing.
Well, fundamentally, the PPAs are running out in 2027 and 2039, so you could also say that the company's paying $100 million for 700 megawatts of capacity for 10 years.
I've accepted all of your engineering. So Southern Company, as as was said this morning by Mr. Martin, here comes Southern Company saying, we want to sell you Mankato for $650 million. Now, the company apparently doesn't know that that's an excessive price. It didn't have original cost numbers. It apparently didn't have any numbers, even with respect to Mankato 1. So they come in, they want to sell a plant for $650 million. But one thing, at least now, the company knows, is the PPAs are excessive. And what I asked the company, is it possible to renegotiate those PPAs? And they said yes.
Is that what the company said?
Yeah. Yes.
Mitch, I have IR 2-5. Can you grab me a copy of that? Mm-hmm.
You may approach the witness.
You want to get through?
No. I was grabbing that extra copy, but you know, it's an extra one.
This is data request 2-5.
So there's data request 2-5, Mr. Majoros. In it, would it be fair to say you asked, well, I'll just read it to you. Can you confirm that subsection A asks, describe any likely impact of the TCJA on PPA prices for contracts signed after the TCJA was passed relative to the PPA prices for contracts signed before the TCJA was passed? Is that the question asked?
Yes.
And in response, can I ask you to read that last sentence of the response on section A on the front, please, with in reality?
Theoretically.
No, in reality.
Oh, theoretically. In reality, an IPP would only be motivated to lower its pricing if it determined the nearest price competitor threatened their ability to secure a PPA contract due to a change in the tax rate.
And you also went so far as to ask, is it a fact that Xcel Energy could restructure its PPAs to adjust for the effect of the TCJA? If not, why not? Correct?
Right.
That's subsection D. And NSP's response was?
To the extent an IPP with a current contract to sell power to NSPM would be willing to lower pricing of the contract due to a change in their tax position, restructuring the PPA may be possible.
So restructuring the PPA may be possible conditioned on an IPP willing to take less money for its existing asset, correct?
Right.
Okay. And then you ask, if Xcel Energy does not purchase MEC 1 or MEC 2, will it in fact renegotiate the existing PPA? And that was sub-question E, correct?
Both the MEC, would you like me to answer?
Yeah, that'd be great.
Both the MEC 1 and MEC 2 contracts are in full force and effect, and we do not see a renegotiation as described.
Thank you. Nothing further. On the next topic, I'd like to talk to you about the customer discount.
We should have that exhibit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Exhibit 15.
NSP response information request number 2-5. I think the last topic I'd like to, well, Mr. Majoros, you also talk about a traditional buy versus lease analysis in your testimony, correct?
Yes. Let's move the exhibit and get that out of the way.
I move to enter this as Exhibit 15.
Any objection?
No objection.
No objection.
Okay. 15's admitted.
Mr. Martin actually testified earlier today about the lease of a car example. Do you recall that testimony?
Yes.
This is sort of the same kind of concept that you're proposing with the lease versus buy analysis, right?
Well, what I've done is, as Mr. Martin said, their fundamental analysis was were the strategist runs. The company separately calculated the incremental revenue requirements, the future incremental annual revenue requirements associated with purchase. And then what he said they did is they did a normal strategist run, assuming the continuation of the PPAs, and then they added those revenue requirements to another run and took the difference between those two runs to determine the savings, if any. So I, in my testimony, at page 18, where I replicated his numbers, those runs that he did where he added the incremental revenue requirements of Mankato 1 to one of his runs in Strategist and compared that with, I guess, business as usual. That's at 6.53, that's where he got his $142 million and $66 million savings from the modified IRP and the 85-30 scenario. And those are the sole, regardless of all of the additional words and numbers, those are the sole basis for his suggestion or statement that this is beneficial to ratepayers, these savings. Now, I did two other runs, as you can see, using the consumer discount rate, and it demonstrates there are no savings at all.
And that is.
I'm just trying to set the stage for answering your question. Now, when I say I did a standalone lease versus buy analysis, what I was trying to do all along was dig the individual costs of the revenue requirements and then the equivalent PPA requirements to compare them without everything else that is in Strategist. So, and I had a hard time because these are confidential work papers and they were sent in such a manner as they were almost impossible to work with because these are the numbers, 2-17. And once you saved them, you couldn't save them again. It was difficult to extract numbers. It was, so you couldn't make, well, anyway. So anyway, so here I did, this is the traditional lease versus buy. And the revenue requirement is equivalent to your car, the purchase of a car. And the lease is equivalent to the separate stream of PPA revenue requirements. That's what I did, just to make sure everybody understands.
And this PPA revenue requirement, that stream, did it include both the capacity and energy components of the PPA?
One of my iterations did. No, not the capacity payments, energy payments. Because the revenue requirement didn't have energy payments in it. The company's revenue requirements calculations did not have energy costs in them.
Where did you obtain the company's revenue requirements calculations?
Exhibit 2, I mean, it's response to 217.
So your analysis ignores any energy benefits that come from
its
the Mankato?
Its analysis ignores any benefits.
If the revenue requirement was pulled from the production model, sir, it would include both capacity and energy.
No, sir. It was an independent calculation.
By you, sir, correct?
No, by the company. Look at 217 of your client's response.
Okay.
Ask Mr. Martin.
Oh, we can't do that right now.
And when I did those...
Mr. Majoros...
I'm sorry.
There's not a question pending at the moment, so let's let him look at the 217. And
thank you, Your Honor. Where is it? Oh, here. I'm looking at number 217, Mr. Majoros. It appears that what 217 provided to you was the company's strategist output, which is the production model outputs, correct?
That was one of them. But you're not looking at the attachments.
Well, I'm not sure I need to look at the attachments.
How can you ask me questions about this?
Let's take time out here. Mr. Simpson, can you show him the 217 you're looking at?
Okay. This doesn't have the attachments.
Okay, so can you tell us, sir, specifically what attachments you're referring to?
There were three attachments, A, B, and C.
Okay. Let's stop there.
Okay. That's fine. You know, I'm just going to move on. It's fine. I have no further questions.
All right. Mr. Pelham.
I don't have any questions. Thank you.
Commissioner Crocius.
Pardon? I know. That was fast.
You're next.
Wow. Moving right along. Okay, just so I have this straight, what should the purchase, speculatively, what should the purchase price be?
Based on what we know, which are not original cost numbers, but I think the purchase price is in the correct purchase price is in the range of $550 million.
Okay. earlier I had talked to both or asked both one of the company witnesses and then the previous witness, or had mentioned in effect, what's the incentive or what, how hard does the company really have to work to drive price down when they're going to get a return on that investment?
They don't. That's why they are willing to pay $650 million for a $500 million asset, or even less. I don't know what the depreciation is related to Mech 1 and Mech 2.
So you've got two publicly traded investor-owned utilities.
Right.
Both getting a return on whatever investment they make in their respective geographies. Would you consider this problematic that a transaction like this occurs, or only, or is that just dependent on the purchase price? And
well, I don't think they acted in good faith in anything here, but I'm opposed to paying any more than original cost, because they do have essentially a guaranteed return, and they get depreciation. They get depreciation. So that's a return on, return of. Why spend $100 million too much?
Mm-hmm. So you've got a... You calculated the break-even to ratepayers as 2042.
Yes, sir.
Did you factor in early retirements and the accelerated depreciation that same class of ratepayer would, or the bulk of them would be hit with?
No, I didn't. I only took the two streams of numbers that the company calculated that produced those graphs. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Martin's testimony showing the upfront loading of the purchase option. I just took those two streams and determined when the early increase rates to ratepayers were finally absorbed by the decrease rates that took place after the end of 2039.
So if that was factored in, could it conceivably stretch the break even to closer to 2050?
You know, I don't know. I would think so. And I think the early retirements, one of the things I do in my profession is I do a lot of depreciation work. And I do a lot of utility accounting, and I see a lot of, or I've heard a lot of things that, to me, demonstrates that there's, that you're not getting the whole story about any of this. And those early retirements, once you retire a plant in public utility rate making, rate base doesn't change. They still earn on that. They still earn on that. So the only thing that stops if they retire is the depreciation. But the return on that net investment continues. That's just a fact of the way the accounting and rate making model works. So another thing that you might want to consider is that I know that the costs that they have, this revenue requirement calculation that they they put in that those attachments assumes that they will dismantle those plants when retired. And they're collecting money now from ratepayers to dismantle them. But the question I always have is, since rate base doesn't change, I can show you on the board, but since rate base doesn't change, why would you spend the money to dismantle the plant when you retire it, when you don't need to spend the money? There's no requirement. They don't have any asset retirement obligations regarding those plants. They won't even promise when they're going to retire them, and they won't promise that they're going to dismantle them when they do retire them. So that's another thing that you know, I'm telling you that now, but they haven't told you. And I'm not even sure that that acquisition adjustment was mentioned in the application or Martin's direct testimony. So I'm sorry if I didn't answer your question.
Oh, you answered a couple I didn't have. Which
oh,
was,
okay.
and the one as well, which was good. So
I have a habit of doing that.
All right, so where was I?
I would stop you if there was an objection.
No, it was good.
And I get excited, too, as you can tell.
No, that's absolutely fine. So I had asked earlier when I was looking at table 10 of this would be Mr. Martin's direct testimony. We had looked at the different scenarios in terms of the Sherco facility, a generic combined cycle, a generic combustion turbine, two brownfield, one greenfield are the different examples. What about the scenario where you take and then going back to the fact that there was, I believe, a $263 million value placed on transmission upgrades for Sherco as a selling point because it's already in place. So $180 million to add Sherco to. And that was a really good thing. But when they were able to replace the Sherco 1 turbine at a cost of $31 million to upgrade. And then I had asked the question, well, why not take some of these smaller facilities that are set to retire resources and upgrade them? Because the interconnect is there, the land is owned, ratepayers have been footing the bill for quite a while. Does that make sense, or would you agree with the company witness that the interconnect, the upgrade cost might be problematic?
Yeah. You know, I'm not an engineer. I've looked at plant life extensions on a number of occasions, and typically, it's pretty well documented that plant life extensions are much cheaper than putting in new plants. Why they're retiring these plants early, I said in the beginning, I think this whole filing was a self-fulfilling prophecy, and the assumptions that are built in were designed to result in two numbers, $146 million and $66 million, which are the discounted savings. The strategist discounted savings in Mr. Martin's testimony.
All right, thank you. I don't have any other questions.
Commissioner Fedorchak.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Majoros. Couple
questions, I want to talk a little bit about the cost. So you say it's $500 million. That's the value of it, of this facility.
Based on what we know, yes.
Can you briefly explain where you came up with that or remind me?
Well, first of all, I'm only speculating because, again, I keep going back. We need original cost numbers, and we don't have. They haven't provided them.
Okay, so and this is confusing because original cost of what? Because there's just one facility that just came online, so it just got completed. So what Southern Company paid for Mankato 1 would not have included Mankato 2, correct?
Well, that just got they're going to purchase Mankato 1 and 2.
Right.
Mankato 1 was constructed in 2000, put into service in 2006. It went into service. The original cost of that is the starting point.
Okay.
And then you move forward with that. You depreciate it. And then you get to the point where Southern Company bought it from Calpine. And it is my suspicion that Southern Company paid a premium. An acquisition adjustment is a premium. Maybe. So my suspicion is Southern Company paid a premium, but Southern Company still had the obligation to keep track of those plant accounts when they were originally constructed and devoted to public utility service.
Right. I get that. I don't want to revisit all that, though.
No, okay.
I just want to get to the point of how do we get at $500 million and what are we adding together? So they've estimated what Mankato 1 cost, correct, in your information request?
I think they've estimated what Mankato cost.
In total?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So, and we don't have the original cost of Mankato 1 included in that. So as things get older in this industry, do they increase or decrease in value? So should the company have to pay more for the Mankato 1 or less, considering that it's went into service in 2006, you said? So it's 13 years old. Should it be worth more or less today?
It should.
Generally,
the original cost should be exactly the same.
Okay, and then
original cost.
Yes,
and
I get that.
It is depreciated.
But what you pay in the market is more or less than what you paid originally.
We're in this is public utility rate making, and what they're going to buy, they're going to have to know the original cost, and probably the accumulated depreciation, and the fact that dollars get less value, or you're talking about the time value of money, I guess, that's not important when it comes to cost, when it comes to utility costs. Utility costs are just that. And they are maintained. You don't discount, you don't adjust plant values for value. It's cost. That's the foundation.
But is there not a market for these products, just like any market, and any given day they're worth more or less based on everything else in the market? And it doesn't just always go back to the book value or the cost. It's what is demand and how much is this facility worth today? I guess that's what I want to know is if you're saying it's not worth $650 million, but you think it's worth $500 million, why?
Because that's the estimated difference between the purchase price of $650 million and the net.
Okay, their adjustment.
Yes.
Okay. So that's where you're saying that's why it should be $500 million, and they shouldn't have to pay more than that.
No, because if they buy it, in rate making, you know, you have customers who, by the way, I'm trying to represent their interest. Mm-hmm. And we pay, as ratepayers, a return on that original cost. There's no, so the premium that we're talking about here, the acquisition adjustment, is a double counting of the profits that the company would recover on that plant.
So do you believe that,
or at least
Xcel,
Southern companies,
yeah,
shareholders are going to get the $100 million. Mm-hmm. So, North Dakota ratepayers are going to pay the $100 million.
Do you believe that Xcel in their negotiations could have said, forget it, this is what it's worth, we're not paying it, and then gotten that price? Or could Southern companies said, fine, we'll find somebody else who's going to pay us that price?
That's what I assume they would have done. And then, I guess I would have tried to renegotiate the PPAs.
Okay. All right. Let's see here. Did you say that when you were talking a little bit about some of your calculations, that you were trying to figure out a comparison between the cost of ownership over the same amount of years of the PPA versus the cost of the PPA over the? Did you ever make that calculation? Is that included someplace?
Yes.
Which, can you point me to that, please?
This is the car example. And that is discussed in my testimony. So I think, page 20 of my testimony. Starting at the bottom of page 19. No, starting on at near the top of page 19, traditional buy versus lease analysis.
Okay.
And it carries through the bottom of page.
Can you just summarize it? What did it show? How much difference is there in terms of how much cost difference in the PPA versus ownership?
Ownership always costs a significant amount more, even using the company's 6.53%.
Mm-hmm. Is there a figure?
Well, mine are blacked out, but I do have the figures.
Is that trade secret?
Yes.
Oh, all right. Okay, I can get that. I see it on the next page. Okay, let's see here. So you do fault the company for not renegotiating the PPAs after the TCJA. Isn't that one of the risks of PPAs, that when factors change, like taxes are cut or there's a drop in gas or an increase in gas prices, those risks are borne by the two parties?
I think there's risks are borne when you enter a contract. And little risks, you know, you eat them. If it costs you a little more, you eat it. But that was big. In a lot of contracts, they call them like an act of God. That tax rate reduction was like an act of God. And it would have been obvious, I'm sorry, would have been obvious to me in my company if something, and I had a contract, if something that big happened, I'd be trying to renegotiate it.
Mm-hmm. You,
in fact, I, you know, if I couldn't, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I would even continue the contract.
Yeah, but wouldn't there be requirements I mean, obviously you can't just break a contract. There would be penalties. And
yeah, there'd be all kinds of things, and that's why you negotiate.
Yeah. Okay. Then I think my last question I wanted to speak to is the comparables table in Mr. Martin's testimony, direct testimony. We talked about it quite a lot. It's on table 10. Yeah, where is that? 14 of his rebuttal testimony, I believe. Okay. Or is it direct? 14 on the appendix of the direct. Are you there? Okay.
Yes.
All right. What do you make of this analysis and how it shows the cost effectiveness of the Mankato facility?
I think this is irrelevant to me because the company's case is based on the savings comparing purchase versus continuation of the PPAs. This is all just fluff.
Okay. All right. I think that concludes my questions. Thank you.
Mr. Chrisman.
Are you aware of any other public utilities that successfully renegotiated their PPAs after the TCJA?
No.
I'm not sure I followed you on your explanation about how retired assets are handled. I understood you to say that they continue to get recovery until their costs are recovered, even if they retire them. Understand you correctly?
Yeah. I was talking with Paul Alvarez about this last night. When you retire an asset in the public utility world, where we use group accounting, their rate base, setting everything else aside, is gross plant minus net accumulated depreciation, which we were discussing earlier. The net of those two numbers is rate base when it comes to plant. So if you have an asset that costs $100, when you retire it, the way it works in rate making and utility accounting, you take the $100 out of the plant cost, so that goes down by $100. You also debit accumulated depreciation, which reduces that by $100. Rate base stays the same before and after that retirement. They earn on it forever, unless you do something to return it. You know, that if it was retired early, in reality, there's a deficiency, a reserve deficiency associated with that plant. You know, if it's retired early, you haven't had a chance to depreciate it to the end of the life. The normal way to resolve that is to use something called remaining life depreciation. And the remaining life depreciation rates are calculated based on the net book value after the retirement. And just the way it works, you recover that deficiency over the remaining lives of any new plant or existing plant.
But if the whole scenario that's been laid out here with all these early retirements played out, and we got a decade from now and saw all these early retirements that our customers are, that our constituents are paying on, the next time the company initiates a rate case, or we could initiate a rate case, and just as in the same way as we granted recovery for those assets, could we not deny it from that point forth because it's no longer used and useful?
As long as you recognize what's going on,
okay.
You know, what's going on.
And in your assessment of this project, did you assume that we would allow recovery of the entire investment into those projects that early retirements are planned?
I really didn't. I did not specifically. I don't know if the company did, if they put some accelerated amortization in the buy stream of cash flows. I didn't see it.
Okay.
But in the revenue requirement we were just talking about.
I don't know if it's a federal law that was passed or a FERC ruling or what that you referenced about having to report the original cost of these assets. What is that? Is that just a FERC ruling or a federal law?
I think that goes back to the Public Utility Holding Company Act of 1935.
Okay, and who's in charge of enforcing that? What if you've indicated, or at least my understanding of it was, that they just intend to report this based on their purchase price.
You're supposed to enforce it.
It's the state jurisdictions that
or
need to
federal,
enforce that federal
whoever
law.
Is dealing with public utility rates,
okay.
That is assumed that you're going to enforce that.
I'm not sure it came over the microphone, but you said it's our responsibility?
Yes.
Ms. Shea's original testimony, we haven't mentioned her for a while, so. She said that the company's not confident that a greenfield CC is a viable option, and that even if it was an analysis conducted by XL Engineering shows the minimum interconnection cost estimate at approximately $263 million. Do you find those points reasonable, or do you disagree with those?
I don't have her testimony of it. I see that. Is it up here?
It's the highlighted part.
Right. The company is not. You know, that really doesn't relate, that statement doesn't relate to what I study.
Okay.
I just studied the costs and, you know, the costs and savings.
Okay. Then Mr. Martins, and I won't quote it, you don't need to look it up, I can kind of assess it here. Mr. Martins' rebuttal. He suggested no jurisdiction relies on customer discount rate. Do you disagree with that, or are you aware of any jurisdictions that are using your customer discount rate idea? Because when you sell it, it sounds very
enticing. Yeah, I know, and I tried to. What I said, his data request to me was, name the jurisdictions that have adopted customer discount rate. I don't know any of them. Adopted it, but I think the fact that we're having this hearing right now means that, and they have hearings like this all the time, it is at least implicitly recognized by public utility regulators. How else can you determine if ratepayers are being treated fairly? because a ratepayer, especially poor ratepayers, like those charts show, the big hump, a poor ratepayer cannot afford that. They got to use that dollar for food and living. So even though it equals out at 6.53%, you know, I got to pay my credit card bills, and I think I use 17%, but if I'm a minute late, they start charging like 29 and 30% to individuals. So I think 17% was a reasonable average. So I think that it is implicitly recognized by this commission and by that statute that requires that we have a hearing. Why else will we have a hearing? If we're not trying to figure out what impact this has on ratepayers, why do this? And I think that the best way, or one of the best ways, is to consider the ratepayers' discount rate, especially when you're giving two streams of cash flow. We're either going to charge the ratepayer this stream or this stream. If you want the ratepayers to make, you know, say, well, you know, pick one, they're going to pick the one that's discounted using the ratepayers' discount rate. And it's not economic to them. It is not economic to ratepayers in this case to pay higher rates until 2042 and then maybe get some savings after that. It's not economic to ratepayers. Might be economic to the company, but
On Mr. Martin's rebuttal testimony, this is a question I had started asking Mr. Alvarez. Do you have the Martin rebuttal?
Yes.
Page 3. This has to do with the term, whether it should be limited to the PPA term as opposed to considering a more extended period for ownership. Explain your argument to me one more time, why when you take ownership of something that you shouldn't consider a longer period of time.
Well, we're trying to make a decision between purchasing and buying today. And we have these PPAs in place. Now, the cash flow realities associated with the PPAs in place end. These are the realities in 2039. That's reality. And that's where you start doing any net present value analysis. All of the savings beyond that point in time are speculative. There's no reality associated with them. But there is reality associated with the 2039. And that's the way the company probably did it internally.
That requirement that the I'm kind of bouncing around, I know, but okay. The requirement about reporting the actual cost, I'm trying to understand the point, and you talked about things that were happening back 75 or 80 years ago, but if someone builds a facility, and let's say it's a $100 million facility,
right,
and that's expected to last 30 years, so 20 years go by, and they sink $50 or $75 million into it, put in new turbine and things like that. Now, they've increased that value a lot. If they choose to sell it, even though maybe just a few years after the upgrade, that original $100 million would be depreciated out, doesn't the buying company expect to pay more than that, more than nothing?
Original cost means when first devoted to public utility service. Actual additions through time get added to that number.
Okay.
They're at original cost, too. So the number can grow.
Okay.
The number grows with the actual reality, what they've done. but original cost in this case is not $650 million.
Okay, and then my last thing, I would like the exact name of that, the original cost requirement and the year and everything so we can reference it.
So, I'm sorry, were you going to get that now or provide that later?
Well, I have one reference to it now, and it was in the response, one of the responses. My question, I think it was two.
Can I find it?
Yeah.
Is it the, so we would be on exhibit, this was exhibit 14, I believe, but anyway, was that the original cost that was FERC definition 23?
Yeah, yes. And that's...
information request 2-14.
Yes, information request 214. Quotes the original cost definition in the Uniform System of Accounts.
Yeah, and all I want is the name of that, like the Original Cost Act of 1939 or...
Public Utility Holding Company Act.
Public Utility Holding Company Act.
Yes.
Okay.
Was it 35? Yes, that's what I thought.
Roosevelt's people were busy.
Yes.
I have no other questions. Thank you.
I actually have one that kind of follows along Commissioner Christman's question there. In determining the present value of an asset, I understand that you're saying the law requires them to have the original cost. But what difference does that make to the value of that asset today? And I want to stick with the car analogy for a while. If you had a 2005 Ford, that might have cost you $20,000 new. Today, it might cost you $4,000 or $5,000. But if you had a 1958 Corvette, that might have cost you $5,000 new. But that could be $120,000 today. So isn't it more important for the company to do its due diligence to figure out what is the present value of that asset today? I mean, the original cost might be something you might want to know. But if you can't get that, aren't there other ways to figure out the present value of the asset?
No. And that's because this is public utility rate making. And they know the original cost standard. And value, in rate making, we deal with cost. We don't use replacement cost rate bases and replacement cost depreciation. We use cost. And Excel knows that, and that's the way it is. So I understand your point, but that's not the correct point at issue here.
Okay. All right. I don't have anything else. Mr. Armstrong.
No questions.
Mr. Simpson.
No questions.
Mr. Pelham.
No questions.
Commissioners? Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Majors.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Armstrong, I guess.
Advocacy staff rest.
Okay, Mr. Pelham?
Nothing.
Any rebuttal case, Mr. Simpson?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. I would say that then at this point, we just have a few housekeeping things to. So if the witnesses need to catch an airplane, they're free to go.
Okay, thank you.
You guys go. I have a car.
Okay. Calling myself a witness.
What purpose is that?
Yes, I'll figure it out if I get stuck.
I will need copies of Exhibit 14 and 15, which are those discovery requests that we entered in.
You have 14 copies?
Okay. Just 14. I have.
Can I follow up with that, Your Honor? I just have a marked up copy here.
Yes, if you can just get them to me in the next couple days?
Yeah.
If I have 2 5 up on my computer, can I email it to Victor? Okay, I can file up here. Have Dave bring the keys back.
Okay, before we go any further, Mr. Simpson, do you have anything further for the record?
I have nothing further for the record, no, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Armstrong.
Nothing.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. Hope you make your flights.
Nothing further for the record.
Okay, Mr. Pelham?
Nothing further, thank you.
Okay. So, late filed exhibits, we should go over those.
I have three late filed exhibits that were requested during the hearing. I have additional comparables that we filed in the Minnesota case to get those into the record. The remaining lives essentially our coal fleet.
Of the retiring plants. Yep.
The retiring plants. And where in the integrated resource plan do we show the economics of the plant closures, and we'll just file excerpts.
Okay, that's good with everybody, those three?
Yes.
Because I had one about the black start capability of the MEC 1 and 2.
We're happy to provide one. I think that was handled via testimony.
Okay. And the coal modeling in the IRP, where that's located?
Yeah, we'll file some excerpts, I think, of the modeling runs and the outputs.
Okay. Okay, so if you'll just send me an email with those three, and then
yep.
We can include those as the late filed exhibits.
It sounds good. Give me about a week and a half or so.
Okay, let's make
Thank
it
you.
2 weeks for the late filed
Sweet.
Exhibits from today,
right.
And 2 weeks for proposed findings and conclusions.
I'd appreciate an extra week on the proposed findings if possible.
Okay. Any objection to that, counsel?
Are we talking simultaneous proposed findings, or could we have ours maybe a few days after theirs so we have a chance to review theirs? Because we may agree with
99%.
Yeah.
And
no need to duplicate work. That's
we'll give you an
us.
Extra week. Does that sound good?
Yes.
3 weeks plus one? Okay.
That works.
Okay. Closing remarks by the commissioners. Any closing remarks by counsel first?
Nothing terribly. I think we've had a nice, energetic discussion today, and I think everybody's questions were very good. I think just from the company's point of view, this is an opportunity that's presented to the company today. The company thinks that this makes sense in the long term, regardless of what the future holds, that owning the combined cycle facility, having it available as part of the fleet beyond the PPAs rather than waiting, just makes sense. There's some cost savings that are shown. But at the end of the day, it's as much as owning the plant and the smartness of doing that today since it's available rather than just the cost savings. And I think the other thing that's important from the company's perspective is to, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. We're living in a changing world and a changing industry. And our application here, and we really ask you to consider this purchase as what it is, an opportunity that was presented itself in the marketplace, and not to necessarily conflate it with a lot of more controversial items that the company has proposed or is now proposing in its resource plan. I think a lot of those items are appropriately before the commission, either in a rate case or in a resource planning proceeding as we try to start kicking that off. We've committed to coming in and talk a lot about our future plans. And so I just ask that while those are important facts and are certainly in the record and are necessary for you to consider, to recognize that we're just trying to take advantage of a business opportunity that was presented in the marketplace. that ultimately we believe the record supports making sense for us to enter into.
Okay. Mr. Armstrong.
Just briefly, I don't have any prepared closing remarks. I think from the questioning today and from the back and forth, I think the commission probably knows where advocacy staff stands. And really, to really sum it up, we basically stand where we did when they brought this PPA to us, you know, 4 years ago. You know, in that case, the need wasn't until 2023, and the savings didn't materialize till years out. This case is even more egregious than that. The savings, the bookend savings here, don't come into play until like 2034. And that's just the savings. The break-even point, nobody has really disputed that it's somewhere in that, you know, 2042 or maybe a little sooner range even. That's a long time out. And we have a PPA in place for the energy from MEC 2 going forward. The commission said we didn't know now. The company did anyway. You know, so we have locked in costs for that part. So we have MEC 1 expiring in 2026. I think they can get that renegotiated. They didn't even try. And the reason they try is they want to buy this. I think what you saw today is the company wants to buy it, and that's fine. But they're buying it at what appears to be an excessive cost for reasons that don't materialize for 23 years. Well, I mean, depending on which, if you use the break-even point, 23 years. If you use the first sign of any sort of consistent cost savings, 13 or 14 years. This ever-changing market and environment right now, we think it's too soon for that, and we think the better option is to hold the course, and we don't think it's going to have the savings or the justification in the long run. Thank you.
Mr. Pelham.
I think we have adequate information and documentation through testimony to provide an adequate record for the commission to make a good decision on this. Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioners, Chairman Crocius.
Thank you, Zev, and to the company representatives, which have dodged out the door to catch a flight, to advocacy, to advisory staff, and of course, Steve and everyone else. Thank you, Judge. Appreciate everyone's time and the information presented, and we'll continue to work on this. Thank you.
Commissioner Fedorchik.
I appreciate everyone's hard work, good questions, good information. It really helps to kind of zero in on the key issues, which are no small matter to focus on, and we'll do our best to wade through them and come to a good decision in a reasonable amount of time. So, Zev, if we're quick, you still might make your flight, too. Thank you.
Commissioner Crispin.
Your Honor, I have a question. Does the exhibit list that was the exhibits that were handed out this morning contain trade secret protected information, or is it all out of here? Okay. Then I have no other closing comments except to say thank you to everyone, including the witnesses who have left. I have a funeral viewing that I want to make, too, so I'm going to shoot out of here just as quick as people with airlines to catch.
I'll just say thank you to everybody. You know, three great lawyers and great questions by the lawyers and the commissioners. I think everybody, in a more contested hearing like today, does even a better job than they do when it's a little bit easier like it was yesterday. And with that being said, I want to thank everybody for the quality of your questions and your performance. And we'll close the hearing at about 4:16 p.m. Case number PU-18-403 is closed, subject to the filing of late filed exhibits.